The heartland of America and the gateway to the West. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Quite a night for you tonight. Hey, get up to my website, coasttocoastam.com. Look at what Lex has done. It's got a picture from one of you. If you're into cats, take a look at it. Kind of scary, I think. Even though the little kitten there does not look evil, as the owners had thought. Take a peek, coasttocoastam.com. Hey, maybe the power of the mind is working. Just maybe. You know, we've been talking about that for some time now. And now one of the things we are trying, aren't we, every day, is to try to get some kind of resolution to the situation in Iraq. And that means peaceful, where United States soldiers don't have to go in harm's way, peaceful so that the good, innocent Iraqi citizens don't get hurt in this conflict, peaceful that maybe, just maybe, with all this positive thinking, Saddam Hussein will pack his suitcase and go somewhere. Listen to this story tonight. The United States would try to help find a haven for Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, his family, and his close aides if he would agree to leave Baghdad. How about that from Secretary of State Colin Powell? That would be one way to try to avoid war, said Powell. He said this at a news conference. Now, just containing the Iraqi leader could leave the country free to join the terrorists to attack America and never leave a fingerprint behind. The president said that in Grand Rapids, Michigan today. That's not going to happen. But the mere fact that this administration would even think about providing a haven somewhere for Saddam Hussein just to get him out and his family and his close aides, you know, that's pretty promising. So you keep thinking the way you are thinking. You never know. Tonight, a number of people are jumping up and down for joy, and I hope things really speed up and not just with traffic. President Bush has set the course now for hydrogen economy. You know, we've been talking about this for a couple years now on Coast to Coast. In his speech last night, he has announced a $1.2 billion research funding to help America lead the world in developing clean hydrogen-powered automobiles. Now, I don't know if some of you understand the ramifications of this. Some of you who may be pretty young and, you know, all you think is, you know, let's put some gasoline in my little car and off I go. If we can convert to hydrogen fuel, which is pretty available, you know it, because it comes from water. Can you imagine what this would do in terms of how we react to other countries? We'll never, ever again have to feel as if we are held hostage because of oil. We'd have enough oil, by the way, for all the incidental things that we'd need in this country. But just to be able to have hydrogen fuel. And this is amazing. As a matter of fact, the president said that a child born today, that's right now, could be powered in a car driven by hydrogen and pollution-free. So that's what, 16 years, right? Kid gets a license at 16. Let's speed that up, though. Let's double it. Let's make it in 8 years. We've got hydrogen cars out there on the road. And this would be, though he says, an immense technical push. He said there could be some problems. Things haven't been resolved yet. But if you remember my guest, Harry Braun, Harry said, hey, one way to take care of this is windmills to produce hydrogen. Let's not just use electricity. Let's be able to generate it from wind stations. And Harry is absolutely right. As a matter of fact, listen to this paragraph in this story. It says, if the United States wants clean production of hydrogen, it will have to change its electricity generation system to include more hydro, solar, and wind stations. And that's what Harry Braun has been talking about. He's right on the money. And now let's hear a little here for Richard C. Hoagland, if we can, because Project Prometheus, Project Prometheus that delivered well over 14,000 emails to the White House in support of a nuclear propulsion rocket system is on its way. When NASA rolls out its fiscal 2004 budget on Monday, a large new planetary exploration mission will be revealed with that. The Bush administration has quietly signed off on a multi-billion dollar class mission dubbed the Jupiter Tour. Now, this is a mission which embodies a radical departure from the past four decades of planetary exploration. The Jupiter Tour will utilize a sophisticated spacecraft capable of multiple jumps from an orbit around one Jovian moon to an orbit to around another. Such capabilities will allow close, detailed, and long-term studies to be made of the many, many members of Jupiter's area's moons. 40 or more, by the way. But I'll tell you what's so important about this, and the mission is slated for 2009. That's the time frame. This will use advanced nuclear-powered propulsion developed under the umbrella of the newly focused Prometheus program. The cost of the program projected to be at least $3 billion through fiscal year 2008. And so even though some of us might have been a little disappointed that President Bush said nothing about Project Prometheus last night in his State of the Union address, it's done. It's a done deal. And on behalf of Richard C. Hoagland, to all of you who participated in emailing the White House, thank you. I'm sure you had something to do with it. A couple months ago, I was talking about a guy who was selling property on the moon. Not that he was on the moon. He was selling moon property. That's what he does. And people were spending, some of them up to $1,000, to buy title to property on the moon. They believed this guy. And he said apparently that he had former U.S. presidents buying the property. He had entertainers buying the property. Well, guess what happened to him? He's a Dutchman. He's been charged with fraud after making literally a small fortune selling the plots of land on the moon. His name is René Wienema. He's being prosecuted after complaints from clients who said, hey, they paid for but never received ownership certificates for their parcels of land and space. Did you really think you were going to get title to the moon? Well, apparently, he goes on trial next month. He said he made thousands of people happy before his business turned sour. Claims that he sold the plots for about $1,000 apiece throughout the United States and also the world with his company called Lunar Embassy. The American company claims that since 1996, it has sold all kinds of plots. Since then, the moon has sold well, he said, in Europe. Last year, the lots were a popular Valentine's gift in, for example, Romania, even though few, if any, of the buyers ever hoped to even visit their property. The paper said that he was jailed several weeks ago and that prosecutors are seeking damages in a suit brought on him by five disappointed investors. How could you invest in moon property like that? I mean, come on. Well, this is what he says, though. Like most things I start up, the moon project had a promising start. But when the rush failed to materialize, I had expected tens of thousands of orders per month. I ordered a car, a house, you name it. In fact, I've been pulling this off for more than 10 years. My employers, my colleagues, my ex-girlfriend, I conned them all. When he gets out of jail, he said he intends to repay all of those he swindled, and he said he has learned to stop lying and cheating. But hey, if somebody wants to sell you some property on the moon, just kind of walk away. Now, again, if you go to my website at coasttocoastam.com, on the right-hand side says Wednesday Hot Topics. Scroll down a little bit and look for the story that says Cyclops-like remains found on Crete. Look at the picture of this thing. Researchers on the southern Greek island of Crete have unearthed the fossilized tusk, teeth, and bones of a fearsome elephant-like creature that might have given rise to ancient legends of the one-eyed Cyclops monsters. Remember those old Sinbad movies when we were kids? And they always had this huge Cyclops? Well, they think maybe it's this elephant-like creature that has given rise to what the Cyclops was in the movies. It's got a large hole in the middle of its skull. It's a nasal cavity for its trunk, and people believe now that that is exactly where they got the mythological one-eye thing that appeared in Homer's Odyssey and other stories. Isn't that something? Hey, the clone baby story. The clone baby apparently is in Israel. The company which claims to have created the world's first clone baby has said that the child is well, now living in Israel. The announcement triggered the collapse of a private legal hearing in the United States. They were going to court to try to take custody of the baby, but Clone Aid people said, hey, I'm sorry, kid's not here. Kid's in Israel. You don't have any jurisdiction. The court decided to throw the case right out the window. Gary Kasparov, do you know that name? I used to play a lot of chess when I was younger. It was fun. I haven't played it in years now. I might have to set up a system where we can do it here once in a while on Coast with the computer. Winner takes all. But anyway, he is playing a supercomputer called Deep Junior. He's come to a draw in his second of six matches. He's leading. He's beating the computer. And if he wins, he will earn not only $500,000 for the matches, which he's getting paid for, but he'll win another $300,000 if he can beat the computer. And he's ahead right now. And he says, quite frankly, you know what? We still, as humans, have time before being wiped out by machines. Gosh, I hope you're right there, Gary. And the original Beach Boy, Al Jardine, gosh, I love those Beach Boys, is no longer able to tour with the Beach Boys. That's sad. He can't use the Beach Boys' name after a U.S. court ruling. Apparently, Jardine's former bandmate, Mike Love, who also tours with the Beach Boys' name, complained that Jardine's use of the name was confusing fans, and apparently it was, because some fans in Florida back in 1999 were really upset, wanted their money back after they turned up to a concert to find Al Jardine's group playing rather than the original Beach Boys. So Jardine and his group cannot use the name Beach Boys whenever they're out. It's too bad they couldn't still all get together. Now we've got open lines for you. West of the Rockies, here's that phone number for you, 800-618-8255. That's 800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, that line is open for you at 800-825-5033, 800-825-5033. First-time caller line, 818. These are new numbers now, 818-501-4721. That's 818-501-4721. And the wild card line is open for you at 818-501-4109. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Let me read you a couple emails before we go right to the phones. George, true story, kid you not, on a cold winter night on a rural road in White Lake, Michigan. I know where that is. I was driving, doing my paper out at about 3 o'clock in the morning. I hit a point in the road where I had always had an eerie feeling going by, and when I caught that distinct smell of cherry pipe tobacco, I got a chill when I looked in my rearview mirror, and there sat a man in my back seat. That, by the way, is always one of the biggest phobias, isn't it? You look in your mirror, and there's somebody sitting there, and you have no idea who it is. Very calmly, he was sitting there, smoking his pipe and just looking at me. When I finally got the car stopped and turned around, the man had disappeared. I never saw him again. By the way, I quit the job the next night. Another one. George, I was snuggled in bed, ready to hear you talk to Benjamin Krim, that fellow, when you said right before 11 that you wish, well, that you really had to look into taking on this endeavor. I turned off my earphones to say a few thoughts. It would not go back on, no matter what buttons I pushed on my radio. I put new batteries in. The station was nowhere to be found. Now, I listen to you every night. So I got up, and I went and got my backup radio. The minute I heard his voice, I felt a shock right through my radio. So I turned it off. At 4 a.m, they took me to the ER room of a hospital with a high fever. They could find no cause. Creepy. I'm 68 and normally in pretty good health. What's going on? And then there's another one. Last night during the Benjamin Krim interview, something really strange happened to me. Normally I won't listen to a show of topics like that because I've been warned by others of the consequences. Well, I did anyway. All of a sudden during the show, I got a bone-chilling cold, George, like I've never had before. This wasn't so much a physical cold as an internal coldness. For the life of me, I could not get warm. No matter what I tried, nothing seemed to work. It's not a flu or anything like that because, well, you know, it doesn't feel like that. I was shaking so hard. I'm still sore today. I feel spiritually drained. I don't know what it was, but I'm pretty sure that it had something to do with last night's guest. So let others beware of what may have happened when they listened to him. And that's Randy calling out of Dallas, listening on KLIF. Well, I tell you, I feel fine. I did the interview, and I don't feel strange. But I did get a lot of emails from a lot of people who really feel weird. They really do. If you want to email me, all you have to do is go to coasttocoastam.com. On the left-hand side, it says Contact Us. Click it, and then you can send me an email or Barbara. Let's go to the phones now. Let's go to our wild card line. You are on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's John here calling you from Winnipeg on the Information Superstation, CJOB.
Welcome, John.
Thank you. You know, I was paying attention to this recent news report that originally came out of CBS, and then the Guardians covered it, and several European newspapers are going crazy. Well, you can look it up for yourself. It's regarding this Pentagon war strategy documents that were released outlining a strategy of sending in at first 300 to 400 cruise missiles on Iraq.
Yes, as a matter of fact, we talked about it last week. It's going to be done over a two-day period, so it's really close to 600 to 800 missiles.
Yeah, in total, exactly, 800 missiles. And the reasoning behind it is completely absent. But the option, the alternative, of course, is to do a better job without the senseless murder of you know, potentially millions of people. And, you know, I can only beg that Americans understand, you know, sacrificing justice for freedom is completely irrational. It just doesn't make sense. And I know a lot of people will go, no, 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 we don't want to think about it. Sacrificing justice for freedom does make sense, but it just doesn't, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what a lot of people are doing, John. On the contrary, I think they're now concentrating on trying to resolve that situation without heavy conflict. And
for
some reason, and I do not know why, it appears that it might be working, you know, and as long as we haven't gone in yet, and there is a necessity here to get Saddam Hussein out of office. I believe that. But at what price for us and at what price for the innocent civilians? I mean, how much can you contain the guy, for example? But the fact is that we're now offering literally to give him a safe haven, that we're giving the inspectors a little bit more time. I mean, something's happening here. So you keep thinking. You keep acting positive because maybe that's working. First-time caller, welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yeah, hi.
This is Javier from Alhambra, California, listening to you on KFI AM 640.
Welcome, Javier.
Thank you for having me. I'd like to mention a few things briefly, if I may.
You may.
I've heard you've been mentioning numbers, especially 111 or 711.
Yes.
Well, my birthday was this month, January 11th.
Uh-huh.
So, 111, and the time I was born was 111 as well.
That's bizarre. What year, if I can ask?
77.
77, okay. It didn't add up to 11 or anything, but that still is strange.
Yeah, and I've been listening to you, too, that same night, right into going into my birthday, that Friday night open line show.
Right.
Yeah, it kind of gave me the heebie-jeebies, but still, I guess.
Friday nights are always heebie-jeebie nights, Javier.
Yes, and the caller you had, I think, two nights ago regarding...
Yeah, you've got a great memory.
Yeah, well, thank you. About two nights ago, you had a caller talking about, I believe, UFO abductions.
Mm-hmm.
Or his family as well. I don't know. I only caught bits and pieces of it, but it sounds a little too familiar to me.
Why, you think that's happened to you?
Who knows? But as well, I had a point. I was at a point where I thought I may be going crazy myself. Street lights will randomly go off every now and then.
That still happens to you?
Yes. And let's see.
Well, you know what? You could have some kind of... let me ask you something else. Does your watch ever go crazy when you're wearing it?
I really don't wear watches for some reason.
All right. So you don't have to worry about that. But I mean, other electronics go crazy?
Sometimes, yeah, television will turn off.
Well, I'll tell you what. Maybe your body is full of so much electricity, things like that will happen to you. We've got open lines for you. In a moment, I'll tell you about the guest at the top of the hour, because we're going to go on a very mystical tour around this planet. I'm George Norrie. Don't touch your dial. And again, get to my website. Take a look at the picture that Lex Lonehood, the webmaster, has posted up there. If you're into cats, you'll like this one. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. George, I'm 16. I attend a youth group at my church on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock at a nearby school. Well, 2 weeks ago, on a Tuesday night, I had a dream. In this dream, my friends and brother wanted to go ahead and walk to school. I wanted to wait for dinner, so I waited and they went ahead. Later, I was walking to school by myself, and halfway there, I heard this scream that sent a chill down my back. I turned around, and I saw a man or something following me. I turned and ran, and it appeared at first that I could outrun this thing. But it took off its cape or a jacket or something. It threw it. It got down on four legs and then ran really fast, George. It soon caught up to me, but I woke up. The next night before youth group, my friends and brother left ahead of me while I waited for dinner, but I stayed home because there was no way I was walking up there alone. Would you? No, probably not. Let's go to the phones now. Let's go to our wild card line. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm calling in tonight because my brother has been missing for 35 hours.
Oh, my God.
Thank you. He was traveling from Idaho to Grants Pass, Oregon, and I'm in connection with several very prominent remote viewers, and they said that he's been in a car accident on a remote road, and he is on the side of the road. He's a paraplegic, so he can't call to help. And I'm calling to have your listeners please pray for him so that we can find him.
Now, let me ask you something. Is he by himself?
He is completely by himself. This is the first road trip that he's taken by himself. And the information that we have from remote viewing is that he has rolled his vehicle that he is in a very, very dire position. And we have a lot of the state police and things looking for him, but it's been 35 hours and since he was supposed to show up at his destination. And I'm just really calling in to find out to ask your listeners to please say a prayer for John and to give him warmth because he's in a very cold area and to send energy to be found very quickly.
Okay, we'll do that. Do the remote viewers, do they have any idea in what area he might be in?
Right now, I've just contacted them within the last 5 hours, and
yes,
they're working hard to disseminate it. We believe he's in Oregon, if you know anything about remote viewing,
oh yeah,
you know it's broad and there's trees, and of course you're going to see a lot of different things along the highway of a mountain road. The closest prominent landscape is really hard to decipher exactly where he's at. So I'm hoping to bypass that and just give him courage and strength and the ability to be found is what I'm looking for. It's just someone to notice that he's there and to grab him because he at this time is still alive.
What kind of vehicle does he have?
He was in a four-door Subaru vehicle that was silver.
And it must have some special driving mechanisms, I guess, in it for him, right?
Yeah, hand controls. He was using hand controls in this situation. It's very icy where he was driving. We believe he slid off the road and is in an undetectable area.
Okay, well, maybe someone, maybe a trucker who might be going in that area, too.
Yes, he was heading down Highway 85 to 226 to 395 to 5 towards Medford, Oregon. So if there's anybody that sees broken trees, skid marks, anything, as well as, you know, as a global prayer consciousness from anyone out there that's willing to lend their energy out to this man.
Okay, dear. I hope this has a very, very happy ending for you.
I will call you back and let you know if it does.
Okay, dear. Thank you.
Thank you, George.
You take care of yourself. All right, everyone, if you would do that. You know, there's not very often somebody calls this program with that kind of a plea, and she's entitled to your help. So you heard her. Why don't you do what you have to do? Let's go east of the Rockies. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Tom in Lafayette, Indiana, listening to you on WTAM out of Cleveland.
Well, welcome, Tom.
I wanted to talk about Planet X, and because, you know, you talk about it a lot, and everybody always leaves one thing out, and that's Egyptian mythology.
Well, tell me about that, because I have a guest on at the top of the hour, and we're going to chat about Planet X for a little bit.
Okay. And in Egyptian mythology, at least the more ancient version, all their gods were planets. In other words, Ra was the sun, Isis was Mother Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then Osiris was the father planet. And then you had this planet Set, which would be Planet X, Set, S-E-T.
Yes.
And it was a rogue planet that came in from outside the system, and it broke Osiris up into 14 pieces. And then by the mythology, Isis, Mother Earth, takes one of the pieces and makes Horus, or Mars.
All right.
And when Planet X or Set came back the next time, Horus engaged him in battle and killed him and broke him up into a bunch of pieces. But it, you know, left Horus sort of, you know, not quite dead, but not quite alive.
It's kind of similar to the Sumerian text that Zechariah Sitchin.
Yeah, but they always act like Planet X is not dead. You know, but it's common mythology.
You believe Planet X is dead, right?
Well, I don't believe anything. I'm just telling you the mythology.
Oh, all right. Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to find out in May if some of the people who believe Planet X is alive rather than dead, because that's when they say it's supposed to come rumbling through, and we'll just have to wait and find out. But I'm looking forward to see what William Henry has to say about all this as well. Let's go to our wild card line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
This is Guy calling from Wichita, Kansas, listening to you on 1200 AM out of San Antonio, Texas.
Well, if it plays in Wichita, it plays anywhere.
That's right. I'm calling about a caller you had about a week ago mentioning some green shooting stars.
As a matter of fact, not only do I remember that, I was cornered by someone Saturday night who said that they had seen the same thing in Illinois.
Okay,
I think I can straighten this out for you a little bit. All right, all right.
I'm an amateur astronomer. I love astronomy. And I see a lot of green meteorites, or I have over the years.
Me too.
And when I was young, I was really curious about that, so I did a lot of research. And it turns out that when you burn copper, it turns green. It has a green flame.
Right.
So if copper oxide or whatever is present in the meteor that comes into the atmosphere, it will burn a phosphorescent green.
Now, for a little meteor to look that green busting through the atmosphere, it's got to be a lot of copper in
well,
that.
Well, sure. And larger meteorites that hit the Earth are usually of metallic origin, steel, iron. Not steel necessarily because it's a man-made material, but iron and copper are very common in meteorites.
So, amateur astronomer, have you ever spotted an extra planet rolling around?
Well, no, I haven't seen any extra planets, but I've seen a lot of meteorites.
Now, let me ask you, though, a Planet X question.
Okay.
Don't you think if it was going to be next to the planet in just a few months, that amateur astronomers, as well as other astronomers, would see it?
Yes and no.
All right. Tell me the no part, then.
Okay, the no part is, and some will argue it, if it is being blocked by the sun, we should be able to see it. But my theory on the whole Planet X possibility, and I'm not saying I believe this, is it
but you're
actually,
not. But you're not saying you don't believe it either, right?
That's right. It could actually come in at the proper angle, and that's why sometimes we don't even see a comet until it's very close.
Or it's already passed us by.
Or it's already passed us by. They can come in at a different angle on the other side, on the opposite side of the sun, and actually follow an orbit with us for a certain amount of time until they come around the corona of the sun, and then we can see them.
Now, let me ask you the other question. If you saw it as an amateur astronomer, what's the first thing you'd do? I mean, who would you tell?
Oh, I would get on the phone. I've got a book. I actually, I think I was the 10th person to call when Hale-Bopp was discovered.
Were you really?
Yeah, I have a 12-inch lens, and I was
sure.
I was looking and looking and looking. I always look. And I saw this really interesting thing in the sky, and I jumped up and down and ran in the house, and my girlfriend was like, "What?" So I picked up the book, and I started calling numbers, and sure as heck, they had already found it. But that's the first thing I would do is I would get on the phone and start calling larger planetariums, et cetera, that anybody who would be watching or have the capability to double-check.
Have you ever seen anything that was really unexplained?
Not that was really unexplained. I saw an unidentified flying object when I was a child. Turned out to be a ICBM test.
Well, hey, that's, you know, at least it's something, huh?
Yeah, it was identified later, but...
All right, I trust you're going to call me back in May when we find out if this planet's coming rolling around or not, all right?
Oh, sure.
Okay, you keep in touch, and as amateur astronomers, you always call coast to coast in case you see something up there in the heavens. Next up, first-time caller, you are on coast to coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, who are you?
I am Allie.
You are Allie's. It sounds like the opening of a movie.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll be sure to include that.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Minneapolis.
Oh, okay. What's up?
I was listening to last night's show, and I'm a first-time caller, and I just started listening to the show in, you know, like early January when you guys did the prophecies one with
yes.
the priest. Yes. Scared me completely. So I was really excited about, you know, Benjamin coming on and listening to him because I had heard you guys talking about it and I'd heard all this about it. And I was all excited. I told everybody. And, you know, so I settled in to listen and I was listening and then my ears started to hurt.
Oh, my. Not you, too.
Did this happen to a lot of people?
Oh, my God. I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten from people who have had strange ailments once they were listening to this program.
George, you told us, like, halfway through to, like, jump up and email you about how you were feeling, and
yes.
I just freaked out. I was like, okay, this is weird. So I was like, okay, I'm an intelligent, deductive person. I'm going to do a little test. So I turned down the radio and didn't listen for a few minutes. My ears,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of subsided, and they didn't hurt as much. And I was like, okay, you're making yourself do this. You've been so hyped up about hearing it that you're now making yourself feel like this. And then
sure.
I turned it on again, and my ears just, I can't tell you how badly they hurt. Like,
and now, how do you feel now?
You know, I was like, ooh, do I want to listen to the program again? And I was like, no, George will make you feel better because he'll, you know, tell you that everyone else was feeling this and maybe it was something. I was a little off today, you know, like
yeah.
just a little off. Like, I don't feel like I was affected in any way, but I got to tell you, usually I leave you on, and as I drift off to sleep, I listen to you.
Sure.
And I didn't. I stopped at like 2 a.m. here, and I was like, I can't listen to this anymore. I don't care. You know, like, and I really wanted to hear what he was saying because I wanted to figure out for myself, like, what's on, but I really couldn't. I was like, you know, even if I do consider this guy to be, you know, just, you know, somebody who's representing or somebody who is having some issue or whatever in his life.
He was very powerful speaker he was.
And you said you felt okay today. So it's like, okay, if George interviewed him, then that's fine. But it was just so weird how
But I've got to tell you, Allie, I took some precautions, okay? I did some very spiritual things before the show, which maybe I'll get into on Friday night during Open Lines. I'll tell you a little bit about what I did, okay?
Okay.
But, take care of yourself. And let's go to our wildcard line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, yes. My name is Tim. I'm calling from Port Alberni in British Columbia, Canada.
Well, hello, Tim. Good morning to you.
Thank you. That's actually good evening. But
where you are, that's true. Where I am, it's morning.
Okay. Last time I was listening, I know I have an echo, but bear with me, please. Last time I was listening to Benjamin Krim with Art Bell, I was listening on my audio link, on the streaming audio link on the computer, and I was in my store and checking out the website with the picture of him surrounded by all those people in Africa or wherever it was. And
Nairobi,
Right, and somebody came in and stole my wallet with $500.
You got to be kidding.
No, I'm serious. And
they stole your wallet?
Yeah, and who cares about that? But I'm a man who follows coincidences, and the coincidences in my life had, you can call them coincidences or whatever you want to call it, but that's how I guide my life, through my gut and through deja vu and so on.
Right.
And this happened to me, and I thought, there you go. There's a good one. What do you need to catch your attention? I'm kind of a money-orientated person. Not that I have a lot, but it's important to me. And not that I hoard it or anything, but that was a really good lesson for me to say, hey, just hold it here. Take a look at what just happened. So I just wanted to pass that along to your listeners. Not that he's good or bad or whatever, just that there was a good little incident in my life to make me catch my attention.
Well, and see, that happened to you, and other people felt a little queasy. And a lot of people, a lot of you, felt okay. And like I said, I felt fine. But I did take some precautions because I had been warned in some very confidential emails from some people that if indeed he was a representative of the Antichrist, look out. And so I did a few things just to be on the safe side, right? It's always better to be prepared, to be a little safe than sorry. And so I did. I'll talk a little bit about that Friday night during Open Lines. But when we come right back, William Henry, my guest, investigative mythologist, we're going to talk about Planet X. We're going to talk about an upcoming trip for Mr. Henry. We're going to talk about a very mysterious hill in Ireland that he believes contains something of unbelievable magnitude. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. William Henry, investigative mythologist has spent more than 10 years analyzing the myths of the ancient gods. William began his journey to the ancient mind in 1984. Seeking to understand the unbounded potentials of the mythological realm, he immersed himself into psychology, physics, brain-mind studies. William parlayed his intuitive understanding and undergraduate study into a position as a special projects researcher at the Subliminal Research Foundation in Albuquerque, New Mexico. There, working with a team of psychiatrists and psychologists, he developed self-help technologies. He produced bright images, subliminal tapes, and holds a trademark for Makeup for the Mind, a pioneering self-image enhancement product for women. Since 1992, William has focused on interpreting ancient myths and spiritual mysteries that relate to the empowerment of the human soul. Extensive database of Egyptian, Sumerian, and Holy Grail symbolism and mythology enable him to detect really the startling ways that history is repeating itself today. He appears regularly on radio programs right here on Coast to Coast AM, lectures internationally. He has inspired millions with his interpretations of ancient mysteries, his edgy science, and the prophecies of the new millennium. Welcome back, William, to Coast to Coast. Hi there, William.
Hi, George. How are you?
Great. Great. You're getting ready for your trip coming up in May, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't wait. It's going to be a blast. We're headed for France. Meet Lawrence Gardner with Jim Arthur and a voyage of discovery.
Ivy invited me to join you. I can't get away this time, but I tell you what, if you ever do it again next year, I'll do all I can to come out there.
Oh, fantastic. That's great. Thank you.
It would be good. So you did some subliminal work before, huh?
I did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very interesting because it really gave me an opportunity to understand the connection between the individual and the universal mind. I was introduced to that concept of the global brain, of the collective subconscious, and the way in which myths and legends live in all of us, and the ability that each of us have from a psychological point of view to tap into the myths and legends and actually begin to embody the figures that we revere in mythology.
That's why I keep hearing in my ear little voices that go, put William back on. Put William back on. So you've done it. You've become very good at that.
Well, thank you.
There's so many things I want to talk with you about, especially your upcoming trip, and I might hold that off until next hour. But I have to talk with you about getting your take on Planet X, because, gosh, it's not too far from May 15th, where so many people believe that it could come around. And up until just today, I kept saying, well, every other astronomer I've talked to has told me, no, there's no way. Then I got a call just a few moments ago from an astronomer, an amateur astronomer, who says, I'm not going to rule it out because it's highly possible that there is something behind the sun that we just haven't seen yet. And to me, that would be unbelievably incredible if that could occur. But William, what's your take on this Planet X?
Well, I tend to side with the astronomers, but I'm also open to the possibility here that we're dealing with an enormously advanced civilization, according to their myths and legends. And they show us in their stories and in the cylinder seals and in other of the temple art that they left that they travel through gateways, what we think of as stargates or wormholes. And it seems quite possible that not only can they send individuals through these stargates or wormholes, but perhaps they have a technology that enables their planet itself to travel through such stargates or wormholes. That seems pretty unimaginable to most, but we're dealing with a civilization that's at least 3,000 years in advance of the evolutionary state that we find ourselves in today. So that said, anything's possible. Am I going to go stand on a rooftop and with a sign that says, you know, pick me? No, I'm not going to do that. But what I am going to do is be paying close attention to the headlines and looking to the ancient sacred sites of the Anunnaki, the beings from Planet X. And I'm going to start following even more closely than I already have the goings on in such places as Iraq, such places as the Hill of Tara in Ireland and other outposts of the Anunnaki, because it is those places that we're going to find evidence of the return of these beings and the ultimate return of Planet X.
What about, William, some telltale signs on this planet? If a planet big enough like Planet X is coming around, are we going to see some environmental changes over the next couple of months, if it's out there?
I would say, yeah, well, you could expect probably a mass incursion of asteroids and cometary debris. You would expect cataclysmic Earth changes. These are some of the historical features that accompany the arrival of this planet. So you would certainly want to be paying attention to the tectonic plates of the Earth. You would be looking at, again, the asteroid belt and for evidence that of near misses by asteroids or an increase in cometary matter and that sort of thing.
You know, as I read more and more of your work, I'm beginning to understand really the complexity and also the simplicity of what you're doing. And it's beginning to be, you know, when I just saw again for like the 90th time Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe.
Right.
And a great movie. And what I always remember about that movie is when he was looking at all the newspaper clippings,
the code,
all the codes just popped out with those little lights flashing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm beginning to think that you are connecting dots for a lot of us to see that are out there. And on some of the things that are there, there's a connection between where you're going in May. There's a connection with what we've been talking about with Planet X. There's a connection with the Stargate or the book you've written on the Illuminati. There seems to be some kind of a puzzle here that is beginning to look like an entire puzzle with all the pieces being put together. Now, that's my perception. Am I close to that?
Well, I appreciate the compliment very much, George. I do get that said to me quite often, that how do you put these pieces together? And in fact, some researchers will send me letters saying, well, your methods are unorthodox, but I take issue with you on certain things, but I want you to be part of what I'm doing because I appreciate what you have to offer. And I feel that what we're looking at here, and again, this refers to the idea of the collective mind, the one mind of humanity, the global consciousness, is that we're talking about a giant hologram that at one time was shattered.
Mm-hmm.
The hologram told the original story, and each one of us carries within us a sliver of that giant hologram. And the object is to use our consciousness to tune into this original story and to bring it back together and solve the puzzle of humanity. And for me, the puzzle of humanity begins in the Garden of Eden with the arrival of a group of beings from Planet X led by a figure by the name of Ea, who sets up what we think of as the Tree of Life, but which is some form of a device that is used to open gateways into other realms. And it's his desire to teach us how to travel through these gateways, to become a Stargate-bearing species that's capable of not only traveling through our immediate solar system, but throughout our galaxy itself. And the story of humanity is that gate was slammed shut on us. But now the gate is opening once again. And we've been given this glorious opportunity to reclaim all that is good about humanity. And we have this one magical moment right now in this very tiny sliver of time in order to walk through this narrow gate and open up into this enormous, beautiful galaxy that we live within.
So what happens if we screw up this great moment to take advantage of this?
Well, what happens is to use sort of a metaphor, is they shatter the mirror again. And humanity is denied access to the gate to God, the gate to the heavens, and we start all over again. This is why apprehending such stories as the Atlantis myth is so important right now, because myth and legend tells us that history repeats itself, and we hear of this advanced civilization, Atlantis, that botches its genetics and becomes too overdependent on quartz crystal technology, computer technology, misuses its power and destroys itself. And all of history then becomes a long march to reclaim that greatness. We stand today now with 1 foot in the new Atlantis, ready to remake the Earth matrix, ready to re-engineer the human being into a godlike being and step forward into the stars. So,
now how do we, in an organized way though, William, how do we take advantage of this wonderful opportunity in order to, I think, maybe change the direction for mankind? Who's going to be the person to come to the forefront and do that? Because I don't think our leaders really understand this.
No, some do, George, and I'm delighted that I'm following Benjamin Krem tonight. And the reason why is because in 1934, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt handpicked a gentleman who was to be his successor, and his name was Henry A. Wallace, who was FDR's two-term Secretary of Agriculture and third-term VP. Henry Wallace believed that he was remaking his body as a vehicle for Maitreya. He said so in letters, and he envisioned a new world order that would arise after World War II that would be based upon creating an enlightened civilization. Now, that didn't happen.
No.
But I cite that as one example of one person who did come this close to entering the Oval Office, perhaps the single most powerful throne on the planet, and taking charge and sending us into an age of enlightenment, or what I refer to as an age of Tara, which is a word that means enlightenment. Instead, right now, we're set up for the next several generations to battle terror. And we're going to be devoting trillions of dollars of our resources in this battle. As noble as it is in its intention, it's flawed in its purpose, because you can never defeat terror. It's like defeating sin. It cannot happen. It is just simply an impossible goal. And until we get leadership that says we're going to begin pointing ourselves in this direction over here, in the direction of Terra and enlightenment, we're going to be stuck in the same quagmire that we've been stuck in for a very long time.
I think you're right. You know, we have, over the last couple days, been talking again in a much organized way of using our minds collectively on Coast to Coast to see if we might be able to alter what's happening out there in Iraq right now. In that, I'm concerned about two things. I am not concerned, William, about Saddam Hussein at all, but I am concerned about our soldiers, and I'm concerned about the innocent Iraqi people there and who are loving people. If anybody has ever met anybody from Iraq, and I'm talking about people who don't support Saddam Hussein, the butcher of Baghdad.
Right.
These are heartwarming people. I mean, they'll give you the shirt off their back. And this is absolutely true. So I decided, all right, let's get an expert on who can help us a little bit with the mind. And we got the doctor, Fred DeWolf, on.
Oh, great.
And he helped us a lot with that. And, you know, sure enough, the next day, our government announced that they're going to give the weapons inspectors a little bit more time. Mm-hmm. And even after George Bush's fiery speech last night, today, Colin Powell is saying, well, we would endorse providing and finding a haven for Saddam Hussein, his family, and the people who are supporting him, and get them out of Baghdad. And that, to me, that's unprecedented. And something's happening, William. I don't know what it is, though.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant on behalf of President Bush to reach out to the Iraqi people and say that your enemy is not from outside of your country. Your enemy is the leadership in your country.
Exactly.
If FDR had done that to the German people just before World War II, millions of lives would have been spared. Because at that time, at the time that FDR met Churchill and Stalin in Tehran, there had already been 6 assassination attempts on Adolf Hitler. His power base was crumbling, but what FDR did is he made the mistake of declaring that he would only settle for the unconditional surrender of the German people, which only motivated them to fight to the very last man. So in this case, I feel that the president has taken a page from history and taken a step that says, hey, you know, we're with you people, and we're going to do everything we can, but you've got to create a space for us here.
Now tell me for a moment, why following Benjamin Krem was important to you. What does that do to you?
Well, just from the perspective that it enables us, in terms of talking about Planet X, to bring up a footnote in history And that is that in 1934, President Roosevelt, at the request of Henry Wallace, sent the Russian mystic guru Nicholas Rurik to Mongolia to recover the secrets of the Holy Grail, as well as to seek for evidence of the reincarnated Jesus. What does he come back with? Well, he comes back with certain knowledge about an initiation called the Shambhala initiation, which revolves around a mystic pillar called Meru, which was the name for the center of Atlantis, of all places.
Right, exactly.
The eight-rayed flower of Shambhala, its logo, is symbolic of the eightfold path of the Buddha, but it's exactly the same as the eight-rayed star that symbolizes Nibiru, or Planet X. And what this says to me is that even back then, when President Roosevelt is sending Rurik to Mongolia, they're actually, and maybe didn't realize it at the time, are seeking the secrets of Planet X, and they become important. And here's a person that could have been the President of the United States that sought to embody the secret teachings of the Maitreya, which in this case appears to have a tremendous relationship to the Anunnaki, the Shining Ones of Planet X.
It's almost as if some of these people take the ancient texts and literally guide their whole life by it. And they follow in the footsteps of what can be, because I think you were the one who told me on your last visit that even Saddam Hussein thinks he's the reincarnated biblical king Nebuchadnezzar.
Yes, he absolutely does.
And I bet his entire career has been steered to trying to follow in that king's footsteps.
Well, as I pointed out, in the 1980s, he spent over $500 million rebuilding Babylon in honor of Nebuchadnezzar. Then just this week, of course, destroyed that city during the Gulf War. He, just in 2002, called up the British Museum and said, hey, you guys have copies of 10,000 tablets that you stole from Iraq back in the 1860s, and we want copies of those. And the British Museum said, okay. And then after that, he calls the Berlin Museum and says, hey, you guys stole the Ishtar Gate from Babylon. We want that back. And what he's in the process of doing right now is recreating ancient Babylon as a Disneyland for the Anunnaki in anticipation of the return of these beings and perhaps even the appearance of Planet X.
Well, is he wacko, or does he have a basis here?
No, the CIA in its psychological assessment says he is not insane. What he does sometimes appears to be insane, but he is perfectly sane. So that means that he must have some basis for what he is thinking. And here in the West, the belief in reincarnation isn't as prevalent as it is elsewhere. But what we find is that, in fact, throughout the Middle East, there are several leaders that believe that they're reincarnated biblical figures. And once again, this addresses the notion that we're dealing with people here that have spiritual beliefs that are contrary to those widely held by most Americans. But these leaders are operating off this premise. They're tearing pages right out of the Bible, and they're reenacting these ancient biblical stories because they believe that they're these figures, and they want to outdo what they've done in the past.
Well, you know, William, if you believe in reincarnation, and I do, who's to say that their beliefs of who they might have been in a past life, maybe they're not way off base after all?
I mean, and think about what that means to us. We are living participants now in the fulfillment of several biblical prophecies, and we are watching right before our eyes the recreation of these ancient myths, and we're also participating in those.
Stay with me. My guest is William Henry. We're going to continue our dialogue about just what's going on there with Stargates. But let me tell you, at the top of the hour, hold on to your chair. You're not gonna believe this one. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with guest William Henry. William, Cloak of the Illuminati, did you see Signs when it came out on the big screen, or did you see it later?
No, I didn't see it when it was out on the big screen. I only saw it when it came out on DVD.
Ah, well, you know what? Sometimes in the comfort of your own home, there's nothing like watching your own movies.
And, that's right.
I enjoy it. What did you think of the movie?
I thought it was okay. I thought, in a sense, that you had to kind of tie half your brain behind your head if you know anything at all about humanity's interaction with ETs, because the movie was written from the perspective, in my opinion, that this is the first anybody had ever heard of it. And so I'm watching the movie with a slightly skeptical eye.
Right.
And then all of a sudden I got sucker punched by the movie.
What happened?
Well, all of a sudden, I had written in my book, The Cloak of the Illuminati, about the United States military's design of the new future soldier suit, where they're going to create this nanotechnology suit that the soldiers are wear that makes them resistant to ballistic attack and to chemical attack, and it's going to have kind of like a shiny, oily type skin.
Yes, it even monitors in case something happens to them. It gives them an injection, for example. If they get wounded, it'll shoot them with like morphine or whatever they need.
Exactly. If they break a leg, the suit will automatically form a splint and help to begin to heal the leg. Just incredible things like that. And so I'm watching Signs, and all of a sudden I get a real good look at the alien. And the alien that they sent in the movie Signs is wearing the suit that the United States military is developing at MIT right now.
From head to toe. Head to toe.
From head to toe, it is an exact match for the description, right down to its ability to cloak itself, to leap over buildings, and to eject a poisonous gas from within itself. And as soon as I see that, I'm thinking, wow, there's a message here.
I'm convinced that Spielberg gets information from our government and puts it in his films. Now, you know what? I've tried to get him on the program. I'm still going to keep working at it. His wife knows some people I know here in the Midwest. And I got to get him on. I don't know, William, if he'd ever admit to that, but it's uncanny how his movies come out before the technology comes out, and then all of a sudden, there that stuff is.
Exactly.
How does he do it?
Right. Well, my friend Jordan Maxwell has a real good explanation for it. He often tells how in ancient times the Druids of Ireland and England would get together, and these were the magic priests, and they would tell their tales and of magic and spirituality, and all of the tales revolved around the magic of Hollywood, which is the material the wand of the Druid was made out of. And as Jordan says, now the Druids are back in business in Hollywood. The new temples, the new church, are the movie theaters.
Ah.
And when we go to the theater and we sit at the feet of masters like George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, and others, we are in the temple, and we are absorbing the images through our eye of the ancient gods and goddesses being brought to life right before our very eyes. And we leave that theater transformed. We, in some cases, become inspired, and we want to learn more, and other times we want to emulate those figures that we see on the silvery screen. And so what we're seeing here is no coincidence, perhaps. It's just simply that the masters have returned of old, and Hollywood is back in business.
When you wrote The Cloak of the Illuminati, which, by the way, is a very good book, how's it doing, by the way? You see yourself? Good.
Thank you very much. I want to thank all the Coast listeners for their tremendous response, and I truly, truly appreciate it.
Oh, that's well. Hey, you know, you're a good author. You deserve it, and so be it. But when you wrote The Cloak of the Illuminati, and some of the thoughts in the book are pretty darn profound, William, did you ever get the feeling that you were being watched or anything suspicious or ever even have to worry about your own safety?
Maybe a tinge of that. I have a tendency sometimes, I guess, to have a little bit of a big mouth, and I've paid the price for it in the past. It doesn't keep me from wanting to share what I uncover even in the present moment, nor will it prevent me from the future. But there's definitely an aspect of that, and I'm asked that question quite frequently. So it's, you know, it's just a choice that I make, and I enjoy what I do, and I'm just going to keep trying to push that edge as far as I possibly can.
I had a guest on, Richard C. Hoagland. You know Richard, of course. And one of his theories was that this entire Iraqi war may be based on much more than what the eyes see, that it had some kind of biblical overtones to it, that there might be something that Saddam is hiding or that we want for some reason. I didn't have a chance to ask you about that the first time, and now that this seems to be heating up somewhat, what do you think about that?
Oh, I totally concur. I think that if Richard and I ever got together in a lecture scenario and we're able to present our information back to back, we could present a very compelling scenario that we're there because Saddam Hussein is guarding technology that belongs to the Anunnaki that was probably imported from Mars. And that perhaps likely there is a Stargate or wormhole technology that is there in Iraq that for Saddam represents in his mind his ace in the hole. Because he knows that the revelation of the knowledge that's buried 20 feet beneath the sands of Baghdad could have a crippling effect on the global mind. He could literally pull the rug right out from under Judaism and Christianity.
Do you think he knows where it is and he's protecting it, or do you think he's got to search for it too?
Oh, I'm sure he's got quite a bit of it, and we know this just by watching the art market, the amount of Iraqi antiquities that are being smuggled out, even by UN people, is alarming to some people because this stuff never sees the light of day again. People like me, researchers such as myself and others that are interested in these cylinder seals that tell the story of humanity's past, won't get a look at this stuff because it's going into private collections, it's going into government collections, it's simply being just taken away and suppressed from the masses. And the reason is because it tells a competing story to that which we have been told about ourselves. And that's the true treasure, I believe, or among the true treasures that's there in Iraq. And that's why we're doing a full perimeter wipe down over there, is to gain control, gain access to the subterranean facilities in Iraq, gain control of those libraries.
Oh, my gosh. Would you like to be on a little trip there?
Oh, are you kidding? That would be just amazing. I mean, in part, that's what excites me about what we're doing over there, in a sense, as long as you know, it comes to a place where this material will be readily available. It excites me, but the historical pattern, well, for example, Adolf Hitler and his second-in-command, Heinrich Himmler, were huge collectors of Iraqi antiquities. They were sending people over there looking for their Aryan origins and bringing stuff back to Germany, to Himmler's Wevelsburg Castle, which was his Grail Castle in the middle of Germany. 10,000 volumes of occult literature all centered upon the Holy Grail and Hitler's passionate interest in stories about the Pied Piper of Hamelin, the figure that leads people into the inner world through gateways or holes in space. Hitler believed that we live in a Swiss cheese universe that was solid but filled with holes that you could travel through. Imagine that.
Yeah, yeah.
What happened to that library at Wevelsburg? Well, after we bombed Nuremberg and began to take control of that stuff, all of that treasure, all of that library, every bit of it disappeared.
Somebody's got it.
Well, yeah, and it's probably the story that I've been told is this is a conspiracy. It's a part conspiracy, part mystery. The story is that a lot of that was brought back to the United States after World War II, and along with a lot of the Nazi scientists and people that understood the implications of that material. Then there's a young congressman from California that's approached by the intelligence agencies and says, listen, we need you to introduce some legislation that will allow us to return some of these Nazi artifacts to Germany. This young congressman plays ball, and suddenly his career is accelerated.
His name is
Richard Milhouse Nixon.
You got to be kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding. So a lot of this is brought back here. Then it disappears, and that's in my opinion, I understand why they do that, They have to do that. It's national security. I mean, what we're talking about here is the ultimate knowledge of humanity. You just can't put that in the hands of the ordinary person. They're not ready for it. We're becoming more and more ready for it. And there has to be a certain preparation that's undergone for that. Thank you, Hollywood.
Well, absolutely. There is an enlightenment procedure here, and I think that's starting. But can you imagine, William, Samaria, which was in Iraq right down there, where the beginning, I think, of organized civilizations began, where, you know, we talk about the Anunnaki and just what happened in that region of the world. I mean, to be able to go there with some relative peace one day and maybe explore it and do a tremendous job doing that, I think might be almost as exciting as what they've done in Egypt.
Oh, I totally agree. And in fact, the BBC has recently made a film with the cooperation of Baghdad that claims that some of the ancient world's most important monuments will be destroyed in an attack against Iraq. The problem with it is that in Britain, the producers of this film are being criticized as producing an Iraqi propaganda coup.
Are they really?
Yeah, and that makes it difficult. It makes it difficult even for someone like me, in a sense, because I don't want to be accused of being pro-Saddam by saying, look, this guy's got the treasures of humanity underneath the sands of Iraq. But that's the reality that we have to deal with right now. But military strategists say that the sites of religious importance have been cataloged. They know where they are, and they have apparently placed off-limits signs during bombing missions. But I think that these religious sites are the actual reason we're there. I mean, we're looking for the entrance ways to the temples of the Anunnaki, to these libraries, to these massive caches. I mean, one of them, In the story that I quote so often, Nebuchadnezzar, Saddam, in his previous life, according to Saddam, opens a gateway through which the Son of God appears. The book of Daniel, which tells this story, doesn't conclude the story. It doesn't say if he had lunch and left, if he, you know, went to the yogurt shop in Iraq and, you know, had a treat, or just what happened. But what Iraqi history tells us, and in fact the history that's subscribed to by the followers of John the Baptist, they said that the person that came through, his name was Nabu, and they believed that that was actually Jesus. And in fact, there was a ziggurat that was built for this Nabu figure, and that this ziggurat was mass-packed with the library of this person. Well, that library is still missing. Imagine the implications of the discovery of such a library, a secret library of Jesus.
Well, if I could get into a time machine, William, and set it back, that's the period I'd want to go, because I'm telling you, I think those people knew something, were taught something, were given something that, you know, is starting to come out in writings of yours and Zechariah's. But gosh, would I love to be able to be a witness to that, wouldn't you?
Oh, I agree, and I feel certain that at least one of the books that you'd find in that library is An Idiot's Guide to Wormholes.
Probably.
I'm convinced.
Probably written just for me.
That's right.
You know,
and me too.
But with all this, and we're leading up to another trip that you're going to take in a few months.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, you're doing it in May, which is kind of coincidental to the planned arrival of Planet X. Did you plan that?
No, I did not. It's just a coincidence. But I couldn't think of a better place to be but in southern France and in Paris in the month of May.
Well, I tell you, that's not a bad place to be. How long have you been planning this trip we're going to talk about next hour?
About 2 years, to be honest with you. Personally, I've been anticipating. I've been there several times and have been looking forward to going with a group of like-minded researchers because, again, there's that collective mind effect that takes over. When you bring a group of people together with a common purpose, you can really make some magical things happen.
How long are you going to be out there?
12 days.
Can you get a lot done in 12 days, William?
Oh, unquestionably. Definitely.
Well, you know, you're bringing James Arthur with you?
Yes, and that's what's going to make it doubly exciting because Jim brings, as you know, a very unique and powerful perspective to these myths.
Right.
And one that is challenging for some people, but is it takes you right into the heart of the mystery schools. Jim likes to say that he has the software and I have the hardware. And it's kind of fascinating the way our relationship evolved, because I first met him at a conference that we did together in Los Angeles, and lo and behold, we used about, I would say, 50-60% of the same images in our presentation.
That's great. Now, everybody listening to him is probably saying, what trip? What is he talking about? You're just going to have to wait until next hour. I'll tell you about that in just a moment. How did you, William, something must have changed your life for you to evolve from a producer of some subliminal tapes into the arena you're now in. What happened to you?
Well, I'm just like everybody else. I was like the Energizer Bunny, reading and reading and reading, just kept going and going and going. And at such a point, I can't exactly say when it was, I suddenly reach a critical mass where it all starts to click. And that's not to suggest that I think I know everything about this subject, but it started to make a tremendous amount of sense. And what I did then is I started, of course, taking profuse notes on what I was learning. The notes turned into a book. And then this is when things really opened up for me. And one of the great surprises of writing books for me was that while I thought that the book was the reward in itself, the real reward for me was all the people that I got to meet as a result of doing this work, all the new friends that I've made as a result. And so that's been a real powerful payoff for me.
What would you love to be able to accomplish in this Middle Eastern resolve, if it can get done peacefully and they can get Saddam out of Iraq and mm-hmm. everything is resolved the way we all want it, what would you, William Henry, like to see out of it?
Well, personally or just in terms
just
of
overall?
A vision over there for me, I would like to see the rebuilding of the spaceport in the Sinai. Zachariah Sitchin writes about this, that this existed at one time, and I say, why not? What if we could gather these world leaders and say, look, we understand your beliefs, but let's take a look at our situation. You know, we can't take Ariel Sharon and some of these guys up in the space shuttle and give them the overview effect, let them see Earth from afar.
Mm-hmm.
But we can take them there in our imaginations and say, wait a minute, you know, if we started devoting our collective resources towards making humanity a spacefaring civilization, and we're going to build a spaceport right here in the middle of the Sinai to prove it, and we're going to unite the Muslim world around this spaceport and link up with what we're doing over here with NASA, that would be, to me, a tremendous step forward, because then that would be the next step from a spaceport would be to taking us into a Stargate in the very same location.
Just absolutely incredible. Stay with us. William Henry, my guest. Now, we're going to talk about his mystical trip that he's going to embark on in May at the top of the hour. And let me tell you something. What he's going to be looking for will just knock you right off your chair. I'm George Norrie. Stick around. This is Coast to Coast AM. Coast to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with my guest William Henry. Well, it is called the Hill of Tara. Just what is it? It's in Ireland. William Henry will be going there in just a few months. William, why did you pick the hill, and what do you think's out there?
Well, the hill sort of picked me. I've been talking for a while now about this war on terror that we're involved in, and this age of terror in which we have found ourselves. And I've been talking about this concept that the flip side of terror is Tara, or Tara, which means love, compassion, enlightenment. And it's been my supposition that, well, based on physics, that for every action there's an equal but opposite reaction. And I've been saying that the more we apply pressure on terror, it makes sense that we ought to start seeing evidence of Tara, love, compassion, and enlightenment in our world. Lo and behold, here comes this report out of Ireland about a recent discovery by Irish archaeologists, the discovery of an enormous egg-shaped temple that lies directly underneath the Hill of Tara in Ireland. Now, they've known about the Hill of Tara for a long time. It's the center of Irish mythology. In fact, it links up with the Anunnaki of Planet X because this was thought to be their gateway into the other world.
How many centuries old is this entire region in terms of the part that I guess is man-made?
Right. Archaeologists date this to 2300 B.C., which is approximately the time of Abraham, who was famous for his Oaks of Mamre. Now, this is important because there's no credible evidence of Abraham's oaks in the Holy Land, but the Hill of Tara, which corresponds with the exact time frame, was surrounded by 300 giant oak trees. And in my work, as well as the research of Zachariah Sitchin, it appears that Abraham was in contact with the Anunnaki.
Okay, now describe, if you can, the geographical makeup of the hill, William.
This Hill of Tara is a giant hill with concentric rings around the top of it. These concentric rings, interestingly enough, are the symbol for the gate to God.
Now, is the hill man-made or is it natural?
No, the hill is natural. What is man-made is the goings-on at this temple. All of Irish mythology revolves around a figure called Iesa, who's known to this in Sumerian mythology as Ea, the leader of the Anunnaki who came to Earth in search of something called the blue stones that cause ill or transform one into an Illuminati or shining one. These blue stones appear to be the focal point of the goings-on at the Hill of Tara, which emerges as a sort of laboratory.
Now, when you say blue stones, are you talking about sapphires, for example, or topazes, or something like that?
Topaz is mentioned. Lapis lazuli was used profusely in the ancient world, another blue stone. Sapphire is also mentioned. Zachariah Sitchin wonders if we're talking about cobalt or some form of a radioactive material.
Ah, because you did say the stone makes people sick.
No, it makes them, it transforms them into illumined ones.
Oh, illumined ones.
Yeah, the ill that it refers to does not refer to a state of ill health. It refers to light ill illumination.
Okay. All right, okay.
And so they come here. This is the reason, according to Sitchin, one of the reasons that the Anunnaki came to Earth in search of these blue stones. Now, I want to put a hold on the Tara discussion just for a moment to say that I originally learned about the blue stones, which are called blue apples also, from the mythology of southern France, where Jim and I will be going in May. And the region of southern France that we'll be visiting is called the Languedoc, which means the land of light. And it was here that I believe that the Anunnaki also had another of their teaching centers. And this is where the mythology of the blue stones, the blue apples, actually originate for me. And so when we go to southern France in May, what we're going to be seeking are the secrets of these blue stones, because I believe that they are literally embedded in the soil of the Languedoc region of southern France. The Knights Templar, for example, knew all about these blue stones. They grew grapes in the region of the Languedoc, because the grapes had the ability to suck up and also filter this substance, and then the Templar drank the wine that was made from these grapes.
What do the stones look like in terms of size? Are they like marble size, or are they much bigger than that?
Well, we really don't know for certain, because ultimately what we're actually describing here, George, is the exotic matter of which stargates and wormholes are composed. And let me tell you why I believe that.
Okay.
In the biblical story, Joshua and his companion Caleb went to a place called Eshcol, which means Valley of the Cluster, as in grapes. They went there and they stole the cluster of grapes, or blue apples, the blue stones, from the Anunnaki. And as they're leaving, or rather as they return to Moses, they describe the effect of these blue stones or blue apples. They cause people to vanish from the surface of the earth, as if they watched people walk through a stargate or a wormhole. Now, a lot of biblical scholars feel that the Valley of Eshcol, the Valley of the Cluster of the Grapes, was located in the Holy Land. But my research reveals that they were actually talking about another of Aya's teaching centers in southern France, specifically the region called Rennes-le-Château, which is in the Languedoc, the Land of Light.
Exactly. Exactly.
So this is very important to us, and here's the connection with the Hill of Tara. What happens is Joshua and his companion return to Moses with the ultimate secrets of the universe, the very secrets, the symbol of the secret science of the Anunnaki. Then what happens to them? The Bible is silent. It simply just doesn't say what they do with this cluster of grapes, this incredible prize. My sense is it's taken, or rather the cluster of grapes were taken by Moses and deposited in the Ark of the Covenant. What happens is the prophet Jeremiah comes along in 576 B.C. and rescues the Ark of the Covenant from Nebuchadnezzar. Jeremiah takes the Ark along with the princess of Judah, whose name is Tara, and takes them to Ireland, to the Hill of Tara.
So you think it's possible that the Ark of the Covenant could be buried somewhere in that hill?
I believe so, and in fact, that's what a lot of Irish researchers say. So I write this article about the Hill of Tara and the blue apples there and the secret throne of the Illuminati, and all of a sudden I'm getting calls and emails from Irish researchers. And they say, wow, you know, you're kind of wacky in the way you're approaching this, and hey, how'd you figure this out? And, you know, we kind of think you're a little bit full of it over on that angle there, but hey, we'd like you to join our team that's seeking to recover the Ark of the Covenant from the Hill of Tara. And I say, well, you know, that sounds like a great idea, but I have an even better idea. And I tell them I'm going to be on Coast to Coast, and what I'd like to do is invite all the Coast listeners to join my ARC team, so that if William Henry shows up in Ireland looking for the Ark of the Covenant, that he actually represents a whole bunch of listeners to Coast to Coast.
Well, that would be good. I'd go for that.
And what I've done is I put up a sign-up sheet on my website at williamhenry.net for William Henry's ARC Cabal, my own ARC team, and if people would like to know further information about it or have information that can help assist in the search for the ARC at Tara, if they'd like to visit, if they'd like to join this mission that we've set forward for ourselves to recover the secrets of the blue apples in France in May or also at the Hill of Tara, I'd love to hear from people.
Super. And your server is working magnificently tonight.
We have a dedicated box now.
Good.
Yeah, Demian scored the big one and got the dedicated server.
Excellent, because you're getting the hits tonight, William.
Mm-hmm.
My gosh, they keep rolling in. Now, let me ask you, though, about this egg-shaped underground temple at the
sure.
Hill of Tara. If the hill is natural and they found an egg-shaped underground temple, obviously there must have been some excavation going on a long, long time ago, 2300 B.C., for example.
Right.
How big is this temple?
It's massive. And in fact, one of the concerns right now by the Irish researchers is that they're building a motorway right nearby the Hill of Tara that is potentially going to destroy huge amounts of the underground monuments.
Oh my. Well, so, now, when you say underground monuments, exactly what do you think is there?
According to the research that I've done, it looks as if we're talking about some kind of a lab.
A lab?
An alchemist lab, some form of a facility of that nature. What's it geared towards? It's geared towards the processing of the blue apples, of the blue stones. Ultimately, what they tell us is there is the Anunnaki's gateway into the other worlds.
This is incredible.
It's totally incredible because no longer do we have to rely on what's going on in Iraq. In fact, Sumerian or Iraqi mythology and Irish mythology perfectly match. And it's arguable that the mythology actually began in Ireland and then went into Sumeria. Irish scholars are saying Ireland is part of the remnants of Atlantis. And Aryan civilization emerged in Ireland and then went into Egypt, Sumeria, and then ultimately into India.
See, when I think of Ireland, I don't think of it as being as dated as Egypt and the other regions.
That's so intentional.
Ah.
The Roman Catholic Church made sure you think that way.
Why?
Because going back to the Council of Nicaea, there was a competition between two forms of Christianity, the religion about Jesus, which is the one that ultimately won out,
mm-hmm.
and the religion of Jesus, which is actually the Anunnaki religion of Ea that centers upon the blue apples or blue stones. When they voted out the Aryan religion of the blue apples and the blue stones based on Ea's original teachings, they set about exterminating those that were proponents of the original Anunnaki religion. Hence, for example, in southern France, the brethren of the Irish people in the Languedoc experienced the first European genocide, when close to 1 million men, women, and children, Cathars, who called themselves pure ones, were exterminated by the sword of the church.
There must be a physical door. Not a Stargate type, but a physical door to get into that temple somewhere, I would guess.
There is, George, but the Irish authorities will not allow people to dig right now. What they seem to be experiencing, what they tell me they're experiencing there, is something similar to what is happening on the Giza Plateau, where they have individuals that seek to form a cryptocracy, a rule by secrecy,
uh-huh.
where a select few are privy to what's actually going on there, and everybody else gets the tourist trap story.
Like Mr. Hawass and company in Egypt.
Precisely. And this is part of the problem. And so I think that's what got some of the Irish researchers excited when they saw my article. Not only did it absolutely nail their beliefs from an independent source, but it also gave them a little bit of hope and inspiration that we might get some help from across the water, from across the ocean.
Okay, you're going to go to France in May. Are you going to make it to Ireland? Are they going to let you in?
I'm looking to going to the first trip to Ireland, probably the first part of April.
Okay.
To go for an initial excursion just to kind of meet the people that are, meet the team that's already there wanting to recover the Ark and to just do some exploratory research.
Go ahead.
That what's happening at the Hill of Tara and what is found in southern France match. And ultimately what we're talking about is the recovery of the secrets of Ea and the Anunnaki.
I've always wondered if now you say this could be around 2300 BC,
mm-hmm.
Let's say 500 AD or 1000 AD or 1500 AD. I've always wondered if some civilization at that time made its way in there, picked up on some of the mythology, and took the Ark, for example, or took whatever was in there and is hiding it someplace else now.
Well, you've just thrown me a softball, and the reason is because according to Irish mythology, again, there was such a figure, and his name was Madoc, who left Ireland in 1100 AD, according to some sources. He sailed up across the ocean, sailed up Mobile from Mobile Bay down there in Alabama, and came to Nashville, Tennessee, where I live. And then he went to Old Stone Fort right nearby Nashville and was doing some looking around, built a small temple here, and then presumably left. Well, according to the latest research, Madoc wasn't here in 1100 AD, which is controversial enough, difficult enough for American archaeologists to handle.
Oh, sure. He beat Christopher Columbus by 400 years, huh? Or 300 years. Yeah.
Right. The recent DNA evidence says that Madoc was actually here in Nashville in 600 AD. Why is this important? Well, it's important because after FDR's search for the Grail and the secrets of Henry Wallace, the Maitreya wannabe, they indicate that they're going to return the search, or results of this search, to Nashville, Tennessee. And as we've talked before, laid out on the ground here is a 2,200-foot-long rod or antenna that covers 19 acres in downtown Nashville.
Right.
This rod or antenna matches the scepter or rod that is supposed to accompany the Ark of the Covenant. My suspicion is, and this is again based on my research of Irish mythology, is that when Madoc leaves Ireland with part of the secrets of the Ark, is he brings them with him to Nashville.
Not all of them, just some of them.
Part of it, right.
What about the physical Ark itself? And again, we talked about the size of it being certain cubits by cubits.
Right. A relatively small box. I there's different ways we can look at the Ark. There's certainly more than one copy of it. It's likely that the biblical Ark is a copy of the original that has definite connections with the Anunnaki.
Mm-hmm.
It has a missing piece that is omitted from the biblical version of the story. The biblical Ark is missing its pillar that is attached to it. This pillar was omitted because it belonged to the goddess whose name was Tara. And when the Old Testament patriarchy set about editing the Old Testament, they had to omit any references that the Gels had any kind of power, that they knew anything that was really going on.
Are there any structures at all on the Hill of Tara, William?
No.
None?
None. Everything's underground.
My gosh. Have they been able to use any special seismic equipment
using all the earth-penetrating radar, all the non-invasive technology that they can use. What they're not doing is providing full disclosure of their findings. And that's what makes it difficult for those that actually want to get in there and have a look-see.
So what if you got in there, you see the Ark of the Covenant in there, and then you see a couple bushels of these stones, these blue apple stones, and what might they possess at this point? Any kind of special magical powers or
the absolute
energy?
Ability to transmute matter, to transmute a human being into a being of light. We're talking about the ultimate secrets of the universe. Mind you, when the Anunnaki come here, they're already a civilization capable of space travel, capable of altering the genetic code. They're capable, probably, in my opinion, of travel by Stargate. And the blue apples are the substance, the exotic matter of which these gateways are composed. So as we look at them from this perspective, we're right now, science is coming to a place in its understanding where we can begin to apprehend what these ancient myths and legends are actually talking about.
Do you think they grasp these stones in order for it to become effective, or do they put them in some kind of machinery?
Both.
Ah, okay, hold that thought, and we'll talk about that, how they do that, and how it might work. I'm George Norrie, my guest tonight, William Henry. Jump up to his website, which is all hooked up with coasttocoastam.com. As he told you, he's got a strong new server there. It can handle a load, so take advantage of it. Let's see how many hits he can get with it. He had 100,000 last time he was on. Let's go over 200,000. Everybody, right now, at this very moment, go to coasttocoastam.com, link up with William's website. Let's see how strong that server really is. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast. William. So they have these stones. They have them in their hands. Maybe you say they use them in some kind of a machine, like a crystal or something. How does this all work, do you think?
Yeah, I'm right now in the process of working with Dana Augustine, the artist who did the cover of my book, Blue Apples, and also the Cloak book, on modeling this and bringing an up-to-date version of it based upon an accurate interpretation of the ancient texts. And what we have to imagine at a place like Tara, the Hill of Tara, and also in the vicinity of Rennes-le-Château is a temple medical facility, an actual laboratory. And in this place, they have set up a pillar that ranges anywhere from 45 to 90 feet tall that has as its platform a device that resembles in form and most certainly function the biblical Ark of the Covenant. What we have just described is what Enoch called, what the prophet Enoch called the Tree of Wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is the Ark acts as a power device for it in a sense. The tree or pillar attachment acts as an antenna. And what this antenna does, ultimately, is it also acts as a drill that drills a hole in space that attracts or opens up a gateway symbolized by a serpent or a wormhole. When this wormhole is opened, from out of it is spit what is described as the cluster of grapes or the blue stones or the blue apples. This is the exotic matter of which the wormholes are actually composed. When a human being interacts with this exotic matter, it bumps them up the evolutionary ladder. Contact with it brings virtual instant enlightenment. What is this matter? That's the question.
That's the question, sure.
And in southern France, again, they call them the blue apples. And the word apple comes from the root apo, which means far away. This is the root also for the word apocalypse, which means a lifting of a cloak or a veil. So what we're talking about here is a secret that ultimately has the ability to lift the veil, lift the secrets of the universe.
Now, are these blue stones, so William, are they earthbound here, or did they come from up there?
They came from out there.
All right.
Definitely. And in fact, there is there's an observatory called the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, which is in Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. It's buried about a mile and a half down in a nickel mine. And scientists there have created this enormous eye that's composed of photoreceptor cells. And you can go to, for example, the Sudbury National Laboratory website and see examples of this. This looks like a giant snake eye almost, this honeycombed eye. It's magnificent. And what they're using with this giant eye, is they're attempting to see what they call tau neutrinos, which they describe as blue stones that are at the center of neutron stars or stars that go supernova. So what they believe that these blue stones are, and these correspond with the blue stones of the ancient myths and legends as well, is this is the matter of which we're actually composed. The elements that compose our human body did not come from our sun. They did not come from our solar system. They came from elsewhere. And it appears that the Anunnaki had a very acute interest in this exotic matter of which we're actually composed.
See, I always thought, William, that the matter on this planet and the elements were the same throughout the entire universe, in that you'd find pieces of you'd find hydrogen and oxygen and gold and all those other elements on almost any planet you visit. So are you saying that it's possible that whatever these blue stones are, that we don't have them in their natural form on this planet?
Exactly. And to understand what they are, we have to go to the farthest reaches of our imagination and also the farthest reaches of our universe. In fact, the latest pictures that come off the Hubble Space Telescope show a picture of a scene that shows hundreds of thousands of galaxies. And at the very edge of the picture, they show these little tiny blue dots. And those are yet further galaxies that we've yet to gain access to in terms of our ability to see them. So the blue stones are not only are they an actual exotic matter, but they're also a symbol of the gods that they dangle in front of us and ask us to try and catch up with the Anunnaki in terms of their understanding of who we are and what our universe is composed of.
Fantastic. If you can find those, you may have found one of the most incredible things I've ever heard of.
Well, yeah, and that's what we're after here. And I believe that this was the origin of earthly religion, was the search for this very exotic matter that I'm describing. When Joshua steals this cluster of grapes that symbolizes these blue stones from the Anunnaki, it's just unimaginable to me that the Bible editors would just simply dismiss them out of hand. But in fact, that's what they did. But there was this whole mystery tradition that evolved around this cluster of grapes. And in fact, in the Gnostic Christian tradition, these blue apples were present at the crucifixion. The two thieves that are never identified in the Bible story of the crucifixion,
yes,
are the thieves Joshua and his companion Caleb. And in Gnostic depictions of the crucifixion, they show them hoisting the blue apples at the cross, suggesting that the blue apples played an important role in the crucifixion itself. And in my book, Blue Apples, I describe the crucifixion as a Stargate event based upon the recovery of the knowledge of the secrets of the Anunnaki and the means to open gateways into other realms.
Could these apples, these blue apples, I call them stones, could they be used as a propulsion system as well?
Absolutely.
Physical propulsion?
Absolutely, no question about it. They also have tremendous healing ability. In fact, that's what got me in trouble one time. I isolated one element that resonates or corresponds with these blue stones, and I talked about it, in fact, on Coast a few years ago. And the very next day, my computer, my research in this area, was stolen.
Stolen?
Yes.
Somebody broke in and took it?
Well, what happened was I was going to Atlanta to lecture with Zechariah Sitchin, and I was delayed by one day because a sudden ice storm hit Nashville, and I couldn't get out. It's freezing cold, 10 degrees, ice everywhere, and I chose to stay home. And what I did is I took my computer and all of my Blue Apples research, and the computer had my research in it as well as my personal papers on it, and I took this stuff and I put it in my car, and I left my laptop computer out in an ice storm. What a stupid thing to do. The next morning I wake up, the car's been broken into, my stuff is gone.
Uh-huh.
And I think about it later, it's like there's no way in any sane moment I would have conceivably left a computer out overnight.
No, that's true.
I think that, and I may sound paranoid here to some, but I think that somehow, knowing with my knowledge of subliminals, it's possible to remotely influence people. I think I was somehow persuaded to collect all my research politely and put it in a nice little box and leave it outside for someone to come pick up.
Maybe somebody altered your mind somehow.
That's what I'm thinking. And because this is what the stakes are enormously high in this kind of research, because we're talking about the ultimate secrets of the Anunnaki. But not only that, we're talking about how to literally transform the human race.
Now, a few weeks ago, Wendell Jones said on my show, and he's an archaeologist, he believes that the Ark is still in the Jerusalem area.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's one researcher who believes it's there. You believe that perhaps it's in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Why two different varying theories?
Well, I think there's more than one copy of the Ark.
Well, like you were saying, that's very possible.
For one thing, and it's very easy to get tunnel vision. I mean, a lot of people want to believe that the events that take place in the Bible took place where the Bible says they took place. That might not necessarily be so.
Well, that's true.
In other words, there's been a lot of rewriting of history throughout the ages. And it's possible that some of the names and place names have been changed. For example, the Valley of Eshkol, people routinely want to identify that with the land of Canaan. But I actually think it the evidence shows that it was actually southern France. And when you go to southern France, you hit a mystery load of the mystery of the blue apples.
Where do you think the original Garden of Eden might have been, William?
Well, two possibilities. You have very good evidence that it was actually there in the Fertile Crescent, there in the present-day Kuwait, Iraq area. But then, you know, I this may sound wacky, but I've got all kinds of Anunnaki symbolism right here in the Nashville area. And in fact, what archaeologists tell me is that all stone sculpture in North America is traced to Middle Tennessee. And I have pictures that I'll be presenting in a future book that show what those stone sculptures were. They were Adam and Eve figures, and one of the figures that is with them is wearing what appears to be a space helmet.
Gosh.
So my question is, if all stone sculpture in North America emerged from Middle Tennessee, and what they're depicting are Adam and Eve figures and a guy with a space helmet, what does that say? And what does it mean
incredible.
That I have all of the Anunnaki and Sumerian symbolism all throughout the Mississippi Valley? Maybe they were here. Maybe America was a part of the old Atlantis, and it did emerge here. And then there was a terrible nuclear winter that took place, and everything shifted over into Sumeria. I mean, I talked with Lawrence Gardner about the Irish concepts and the research there, and he says there's no question that Irish history and mythology predates that of Sumerian Iraq by 1,000 years.
1,000 years.
Right, which means that the Irish people might actually be right, that the migration did start in Ireland, and then it went into Egypt, Sumeria, and India, rather than the other way around.
I've got to ask you this, because it's a question I've always wanted to ask somebody, and you might know, you might not, but you know, the myths of Ireland, William, about leprechauns, to me, it's more than just the symbolism of a little person who grants you a wish if you catch him.
Right.
This, to me, there must have been something going on there for these myths to just be all over the countryside. What do you think a leprechaun might have been?
Well, I can offer a suggestion based upon what a fairy was.
All right.
The Anunnaki were described as tall, fair-skinned, and fairly attractive in appearance. Well, after the church finally won its battle against the religion of Ea, the fair folk were given a diminutive Y suffix, and they became the fairy folk. Now the image of them is diminished from tall, beautiful, grand figures into tiny figures of myth that live in the she mounds at the Hill of Tara. And now generations of people are brought up to believe that the fair ones, the fair folk, are figures of imagination, that they don't exist. But yet Irish history says that they do, and that they were something completely different than people were brainwashed into believing.
I always thought maybe they were little spacemen. When I was a kid, I always believed that.
Well, I think that's entirely possible too, George, and in fact, I personally believe, based on my research, that the Anunnaki were masters also of nanotechnology, the very small. And I think possibly those myths of the leprechauns and the wee people have to do with their generation, their creation of a brand new world at the nano level.
Well, and who's to say, William, if there is intelligence out there, in the universe, who's to say what the proportions of size might be? I mean, it's entirely possible that the intelligence may have created a being that might be the size of an ant.
Precisely.
And a spaceship to them might come up to your knee, for example.
Exactly.
Yet it could be huge to somebody like that.
Exactly. And that's what, mystically speaking, has always made humanity special. We have the ability to see the enormously large. We can see hundreds of thousands or billions of galaxies out there. And then we can see into the very small. And now we have the ability right now to actually build at the very small level. We have the ability to push atoms around and build a future warrior out of this understanding. We also have the ability to remake the Earth matrix. We can totally clean the planet through nanotechnology. But with the same understanding, the same science, we have the ability to build gateways that connect us with those hundreds of billions of galaxies out there. And that's what makes us incredibly special.
You have written, of course, about a number of projects in your career. If you were walking along a beach one day and you kicked the sand and up popped a little Aladdin's lamp and you rubbed the thing and a genie popped out, William, and you got that one wish, with the work that you've done, what would you wish for?
Well, that's a great question. Wisdom. Just like Solomon, I would wish for wisdom.
You would?
Yes.
That's an interesting wish. I don't know what I'd pick. I would like to go back thousands of years just to see civilization and to really see if they might have had that kind of technology. I mean, because like you, I am just fascinated by the writings of ancient civilizations about, you know, the spaceship center that Zechariah writes about, for example. I mean, I'd love to see that. Love to see the landing pads.
Right. I mean, yeah, the what's left of them is truly remarkable. And we can only imagine what life was like at Baalbek in Lebanon or in the Sinai Peninsula and that kind of thing. And that's why I think it would be a key to peace, perhaps, to recreate those spaceports in the Sinai. Because peace, as I say so often, is not the absence of conflict between warring factions or jealous religions. It's the unity of heaven and earth. It's when we are coming and going from the stars and we are a united civilization that is beyond these petty conflicts.
Because we really don't see how they got here. Now, you're using the Stargate theory, which may be the only theory that makes sense, because my question was going to be, where are the remnants of their spaceships and where did they go?
Well, if you ask Zechariah Sitchin, he'll take you to the Cairo Museum and he'll show you a conical-shaped Benben stone that appears to have a god or goddess in a welcoming gesture waving at you. And he would say, well, if you compare this to an Apollo capsule, it's a perfect match. And so he would suggest to you that this is an example of a remnant. This was modeled after their technology.
Yeah, but what happened to that capsule? I mean,
well,
did it take off?
What happened to the actual capsule? Well, this is then, now you're talking about the Hall of Records concepts where people are describing, envision seeing various beings in homeostasis or in states of suspended animation and this sort of thing with examples of working technology. That's always been part of the promise of the Egyptian Hall of Records, that we would find working models of this actual technology, including the pyramid and how it was built and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, I'm beginning to wonder if the Stargate theory may be correct. Maybe there was no spaceship. Maybe it was merely a Stargate in and a Stargate out, and that was it. And either they all stayed or they all left. It doesn't matter, because if we look like they did, they probably just passed on.
Right, but again, Sitchin and others maintain that they never left. Some of them are still here, walking the earth, perhaps reincarnating even today. And that, again, brings us right back into Saddam Hussein. Why? Well, because he believed, in his belief that he's the reincarnated Nebuchadnezzar, we have to look at Nebuchadnezzar's story, and he says that he was the reincarnated Nimrod, the biblical king who built the Tower of Babel, a word that means gate, but which was later changed by the Hebrew scribes to mean confusion after the gate was destroyed. Nimrod's name is Marduk, which is another name for Nibiru or Planet X.
Well, that's true. That is bizarre by itself. Stay with us. William Henry, my guest. Top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you by flipping a switch. Give you an opportunity to chat with William Henry. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. back. I'm George Norrie. We'll be taking your calls momentarily with my guest, Mr. William Henry. How are you doing on hits, William? I always love to monitor that during Coast to Coast. Do you have any idea?
No, I don't, George. I sure don't. But I did want to take an opportunity to invite everybody to, if they're interested in the France trip, to visit my website, williamhenry.net, of course, or the StargateMysterySchool.com. And you can get all the info. And I wanted to mention, too, that James Arthur and I will be giving a Blue Apples Stargate Mystery School conference in Los Angeles in February.
Oh, are you? Okay, tell me a little bit about that.
Right. It's going to be a five-hour event. And, again, the info is at StargateMysterySchool.com or WilliamHenry.net. And what we're going to do is just really lay out over a 5-6 hour period, the basics of this mystery so that anybody can step into it and begin to tune into it and help us solve this mystery.
Well, you have pictures of what you think these stones or apples, these blue apples look like?
Definitely. We're going to have some incredible slideshows that go with it. We're going to be videotaping it as well. And so if Coast listeners want to stay tuned, or we can let you know when they're available, we'll make a special price available for Coast listeners that want to get involved with this, because it really takes you right to the center of the Mystery School teachings. It tells you, it offers you a chance to not only learn and understand what they are, but to actually begin to participate in what the ancients were talking about.
William, have you ever videotaped one of your travels, or will you do it on this coming trip in May?
Oh, absolutely. We wouldn't miss this opportunity to get it on videotape. And in fact, I have a Cloak of the Illuminati 3.5-hour lecture where the tapes will be available shortly through my website. And so that there's another way to access that information. So just try to make it available in as many ways as possible.
I want to know who the model is on the cover of the Cloak of the Illuminati. That is a wonderful picture.
Yeah, isn't it phenomenal? Dana Augustine is the artist who did that. And as I mentioned, we're collaborating on really trying to unfold these Mystery School teachings. That model is that she's actually based on the ancient goddess whose name was Mari or Mary.
Okay. Is it a real person that she sketched, or did she just make it up in her mind?
Dana's actually a man.
Oh, Dana's a man. Okay.
Right. And I'm not
sure. Well, you know, I had a 50-50 chance, and I took the wrong way. Huh?
Yeah, I thought the same thing at first. But, no, Dana's an incredibly talented artist. And he
Sorry,
just
Dana.
A real good feel for bringing this forward. And I'm just totally enjoying the collaboration with him. And over the coming months here, we're going to really lay this out so that in a really nice visual fashion, you can step into these Mystery School teachings.
So it would be a man artist to draw a picture of that woman on the Cloak of the Illuminati.
Right.
Well, it was very well done. Animation like that and graphics, I think, is a special gift, William.
It truly
really is. Let's go to some of the calls. Let's go to our wild card line. You are on Coast to Coast with William Henry. Hi there.
Hi, this is Susie from Detroit area, listening on CKLW.
Well, hello, Susie.
How are you, old Detroiter?
Good.
This is a really fascinating program, and it ties in with some other good ones you've had that are tangentially related here. This is great, Mr. Henry.
Well, thank you, Susie. I'm from Birmingham originally.
No kidding.
Yeah,
right up the street from me. I'm actually in Royal Oak.
Is that right? Yeah.
It was so close to Detroit. I'm a Detroiter. But here's my question.
Up there at 13 Mile and Woodward, you remember when they had some trouble there a long time ago?
13 and Woodward.
Well, how about the Woodward Dream Cruise nowadays goes right by there?
Yeah, but this was 1972, I think.
Oh, riots in the big parking lot.
You got it. You remember that? I covered that story.
Yeah, we live at 13 Mile, a little east of there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I used to cruise Woodward all the time when I was a teenager.
That's
great, George. I didn't know you had a Detroit connection.
Oh, I was born there. Yeah.
Detroit boy.
Yeah,
that's great.
Okay, let me get my question before I use up all your time, guys.
No. We're reminiscing, so it's your time now. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I have to ask you something, and this is not meant to be provocative or rude or to poke a hole in anything, because I think you've just done wonderful research, but I have to ask you this. You know, the term that you used for the south of France is pronounced, the C at the end of that is pronounced, it's Languedoc.
Right.
It means long is language, and Oc is the word for yes in the ancient days, you know, the old dialect there.
Yes,
it simply
correct.
Means language of Aucas, yes, and up north it's Longadwi. We, you know, is yes, up north. But how are you getting this land of light from that, and where do you get?
Ak is the also the root for ocular, which means eye, rather. And in Egyptian, Ak means light. And the reason that I'm able to do this, Susie, is because the Cathars, who lived in the Languedoc or Languedoc, believed or were told, history tells us, that they were taught a special language system by Jesus, and that they interpreted the Gospels in this language system that was called the language of the birds. This language of the birds is a phonetic language system that uses phonetic similarity to link concepts. And in this way, I'm able to link the suffix ak, O-C, with such words as ocular, eye, and also the Egyptian phonetic word ak, which means light.
Great. And apo, of course, apo is not anything like AP in French. Where do we get apo meaning far away?
Apo, if you look in your Webster's dictionary at the root apo, A-P-O, you will find that it means far away, and so the root for apocalypse.
Yeah, but it's... Oh, apocalypse. Okay.
What I'm asking you to do...
Go to a different word in French then.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
What I'm asking
thanks,
you
Susan.
To do is take a leap from the left brain and unite your right brain and employ what is called whole brain thinking in some circles and what is called the bardic thinking, the language of poetry by others. See, this is how it works. They take something like the language of the birds. In Ireland, the birds are called bards.
Bards
are poets. So now the language of the bards is the language of the poets.
I know a farmer in southern Illinois who says bards.
Yeah, and you take it one step further. If you ask a child to say the word bird, sometimes they might say bud in child speak.
I have not asked you, William, about the apocalypse yet and your views on that and whether you think, like some, that we're right in the middle of it right now.
That's a possibility. And to answer that... Let me finish the statement I was making about the buds, because the buds is the Buddhas as well. And what I'm suggesting here is that this language of light, the language of the birds, is the language of illumination, the language of the illumined ones, the Illuminati, which includes the Buddhas and other enlightened masters. To them, the apocalypse is simply the lifting of the veil or lifting of the gate. And this is a reference back to the Garden of Eden story, when the gate was closed to humanity and Yahweh stationed cherubim on either side of this gate with a flaming sword. Well, now we appear to have transcended that sword. The gate is open for us again, and we're now embarking on our new adventure. We have lifted the veil or lifted the gate, and the apocalypse is over from that perspective. It has little to do from this perspective, with the total destruction of the human race.
Well, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Totally. I mean, and that's the importance here of making the leap from the left brain, literal interpretation, to the right brain, poetic, and uniting the two concepts, because it ultimately takes us to the very center of the Mystery School teachings and can transform us into these enlightened beings. We all become bards or poets or Buddhas, enlightened ones.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Russ listening on KHAL radio in Denver.
Well, welcome, Russ. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. First time I've called. I've listened for years. I have been downloading information from the Universal Mind for about 20 years now. And recently I've approached the subject of exactly what is it that Bush is after over in Iraq. And I come up with... some words that I'd like to run by William and see if
all
he
right.
can shed some light on it.
Give it a try.
Deeper meaning, hopefully. Yeah, what I come up with is Babylon, Vortex, Ancient Device, and Photon.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, Babylon was the first word?
Babylon.
Oh, Babylon.
Babylon. Babylon.
Yeah.
Okay.
Babylon. Ancient, as in ancient Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
All of those align
in my scheme of things here. It's interesting, too, Russ. The last time I was on Coast talking with George, I had a very interesting person call me from here in Tennessee. His name's Tom Bogan. And Tom is a Torah code researcher, Are you familiar with the Torah code?
A little bit.
The Bible codes?
Mm-hmm. Bible code, sure.
Yeah, they have these computers, this software that enables you to isolate sections of the Bible. And what Tom did is he took the book of Daniel, in particular the part that describes Nebuchadnezzar opening the Stargate in Babylon. And lo and behold, a series of words popped out of the Bible code software. The words include apple, pillar, mall, code, open, key, alien, door, tone, America, Nashville, music, sesame, apple, and starship. Now, all of those are resonant words that apply. The bizarre part of this is that the text, the book of Daniel, was written 3,000 years ago. And lo and behold, through the Bible code search, we find that the words are relevant to my research today. And what Tom is saying to me is that the probability of this happening is astronomical. He's getting the new software that can calculate the probability of this actually happening. And what I suggest to Tom and what I suggest to you is that when you are downloading words like this, it's all applicable. It works. But the trick to it is not to allow it to, sometimes a banana, as someone approached me in a lecture, said, sometimes a banana is just a banana.
But why do it in code, though, William? What's the purpose of the code?
Well, it's like a myth or a fairy tale. It's designed to preserve and protect a core of secrets so that they can be translated throughout the ages. As Tom says, in the case of the book of Daniel, one of the key prophecies in Daniel is that at the time of the end, knowledge will double. And it appears from the perspective of Bible code researchers or Torah code researchers, it was all awaiting the invention of the computer for us to reveal this knowledge. And it's sort of like the Blue Apples concept again, George, where once you enter one door, you don't stay there. There's always another door that's beyond that. And now you set your sights on going up to the next higher level.
All right, great. Thanks for your call. I've always wanted to pick your brain, William, on the ancient 15th century type paintings that depict UFOs in the background.
Right.
And that that stuff just blows my mind when I see those things.
Mine too. And on my website, I have what I call the Stargate Crucifixion that shows the crucifixion as a Stargate event and features those very paintings. And along these lines of what we've been talking with Susie and to some extent with Russ, a scientist will look at that and say, well, you can't look at that and say it looks like a UFO, therefore it is. That's erroneous thinking. That's illogical.
Yeah, but then my question would be then, what is it?
Exactly. And this is my point, where now we have to cross that bridge of faith and unite the left and right brain, and we come up with a very valid concept that the crucifixion was a Stargate event, and there were spaceships or starships present at that event. Mind you, those paintings that you're describing were not painted by free men. These were not people that sat down in their living room one day and said, oh, I'm going to paint a nice crucifixion scene, and I think I'll put spaceships in it. Those artists were told what to paint by church authorities. And I've made it my business to collect as many images like that, examples of artwork, particularly from the 12th to 15th century is where you find the mother lodes of crucifixion scenes that seem to depict
mm-hmm.
technology and the opening of gateways into other realms.
I know, that stuff is just fascinating to me. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're with William Henry. Hi.
How are you doing, George?
Good.
This is Mike calling from Fontana, California. Listen to you on AM 640 KFI.
Sure thing. Hi, Michael. Go for it.
Hi, Dan. Mr. Henry, I wanted to know a little bit about ancient texts, how they, like the ancient Persian texts, the ancient Tibetan texts of the Buddha. How many texts are out there that tell us about this Planet X? I'm trying to look up in the Bible what it's trying to tell me, but I'm looking at Revelation, Daniel, and the only thing I can see is from Ezekiel, but I just wanted to know what other texts are out there that you've been referred to and studied that talks about Planet X.
Right. Have you looked into, like, for example, the works of Zechariah Sitchin?
Yeah, I have looked at that.
There's your mother lode right there that's going to take you to the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's going to talk about the Babylonian and Sumerian creation myths, the Enuma Elisha, and others that describe this. The Bible, the Old Testament, is sort of it doesn't provide much of the backstory. And see, that was the beauty of the discovery of the Sumerian and Assyrian and other texts in the 1850s was all of a sudden they're looking at these texts and they're realizing that they're telling a whole prehistory of the human race before the creation of Adam and Eve. And they're telling about this what they call the exploded planet hypothesis. And you're going to have better success if you look up the word Tahome or red dragon or other words such as along those lines there that refer to this exploded planet, which was called Tiamat.
Okay.
Because the Bible is more of a reference work for that planet as opposed to Planet X or Nibiru.
Can I also be referred to like the prophecies of Nostradamus I know he was a dark prophet, but I just want to know if he had. I've looked through his prophecies, but I don't see any like planet coming. He didn't prophesy that, and I'm just trying to see if he had any insight.
He did when he referred to the King of Terror, which is one of his most famous quatrains that most people are familiar with. That's been why people have made many attempts at interpreting that. Ea and the Anunnaki were called terrors by the Hebrew people. And so you could make a connection there that the King of Terror that Nostradamus is referring to are actually the Anunnaki.
Well, that could be. I guess the King of Terror could be looked at as almost anybody in civilization who has unleashed his unwieldy power, I think, on people. Nostradamus was, I don't know how much research you've done into him, William, in terms of writings, but his prophecies continue to just fascinate me. They really do.
Me too. Yeah, I've spent considerable time looking into them, and in fact, it was Nostradamus that pointed out to me that there's a missing piece to the Ark of the Covenant, that there was a pillar that was going to be found,
mm-hmm.
and that this would be an attachment to the Ark. And so when I interpreted that or ciphered that out of one of his quatrains, then I began looking for evidence of this pillar attachment, and lo and behold, I found it.
How tall do you think the pillar was?
45 to 90 feet tall.
Oh, you're kidding. Was that big?
Oh, yeah, it's enormous.
Huge. Huge. Okay, stay with us. William Henry, my guest, will continue to take your phone calls right up until the top of the hour. And again, if you haven't gotten over to his website, do so by going to williamhenry.net. Or, of course, it's linked up. It's very easy. Lex has it all set up by going to coasttocoastam.com. On the right-hand side, you look for William Henry under tonight's guest. Click that on. And there you are. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, with William Henry. William, will you be able to, when you go out to Ireland, will you be able to do any digging at all?
Probably not. What we're going to be doing is conferring with some of the directors of what they call the National Heritage Project there, the Discovery Program. And also, I'll be networking with some of the other authors and researchers, the Irish authors and researchers that have been working on this for a while. And what we're primarily interested in doing right now is generating awareness of this situation there. And that, again, is why I formed the Arc Cabal on my website, is to help generate awareness and publicity for this, in a sense, in a way to help put pressure on those that have the ability to reveal the secrets of this find there to go ahead and do so, to let them know that there's a many, many millions of people in America that would like to see these secrets brought forward. And so that's the primary mission right now, and that's what I'm inviting everybody to join in on. If they have special area of expertise, if they have special questions, go ahead and drop me an email. And what I intend to do is when they invite William Henry to be part of their ARC discovery team, I intend that William Henry's not an individual, but is a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, a whole mass of people. That's a good idea. You know, while you're there, too bad you can't make a little trip up to Loch Ness in Scotland, because I'm told they're having some incredible UFO reports lately.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, Scotland's one of my favorite places. Roslyn Chapel, of course, is another of the repositories for the Grail secrets, and it's just an incredibly mysterious land.
Do you ever get involved in the Shroud of Turin and research into that?
I have. I can't get arrested with a depiction that I have uncovered in 1798. Napoleon took 500 savants and artists with them into Egypt. Napoleon wanted to become a pharaoh, and he wanted to be initiated in the Egyptian mystery schools, and so he had all these artists that massively documented all the Egyptian temples. At Alexandria, one of his savants, again in 1798, draws a depiction of a bas-relief from a wall, probably in Alexandria, that shows the exact same face that appears on the Shroud of Turin on the body of a serpent.
No, that's weird.
It is totally weird, and Shroudies refuse to answer my calls when I ask them, say, now wait a minute, you maintain that there's only one image like that face on the face of the Shroud of Turin. That's incorrect. There is two, and you know what? The one that I've found in this book of Napoleon's drawings predates the photograph of the shroud by 100 years. And it's still, you know, it's something that I am thoroughly just bejeweled by. It's like, how does this happen? I mean, obviously, Napoleon's artist is drawing a bas-relief that exists on a wall, but the artist who originally sculpted this bas-relief had to have seen the man.
Yes.
The living man. And
you would
know
think
what?
So.
There's a woman portrayed beside him whose face is also on the body of a serpent. I have an article on my website called Christ's Cosmic Wormhole, where you can go and take a look at this very depiction that I'm describing. And it's incredibly provocative. It's a little bit unnerving for some people, but the fact of the matter is that the Gnostic Christians portrayed Jesus as the serpent, the serpent that Moses said must be lifted in the end times. And in my view, the serpent that is lifted is the mouth of the wormhole. It is the apprehension or comprehension of the secrets of stargates or wormholes that is being represented. I mean, surely Jesus Christ is not a snake.
No, of course not.
This is a symbol for something else. And this, again, is the taking it out of the literal left brain context over into the right and saying, what is being portrayed here? Wisdom, serpent, the word serpent and soul are interchangeable in various traditions. Are they describing a soul? Or is it, as I'm suggesting, that they're describing that this is the person is actually a stargate or a wormhole. And in fact, Buddha, Quetzalcoatl, Vishnu, and almost all the other saviors, including Aya, the original savior figure on earth, were portrayed in exactly the same manner, a bearded man on the body of a serpent.
Fascinating observation, William. Let's go to the calls. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with William Henry. Hi there.
Hi, this is Melissa, and I'm calling from Fresno, California, and I'm listening to you on KMJ 580 AM.
Welcome to Coast to Coast, Melissa.
I was wondering about a few things. First, William, Are you familiar with Blu-ray children?
Is this the same as the Indigo children?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And does that have anything to do with what you're going to look for or anything? Or is there a connection between Ireland and the Blu-ray children? Because you're talking about blue apples and then the blue stones. And so, and they're light. So
right.
I'm trying to figure out if they're, like, connected.
There is a definite resonance there. I mean, let's just for a moment think about the world that the children that are just coming into this world are going to grow up in. If what I'm saying is partially correct, and if you flip through Discover Magazine or Popular Science, as this new technology comes online, we are talking about a new race of human beings who will have in their hands the secrets, what we used to consider the secrets of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
But to them, it will seem like kindergarten. And as they grow up and evolve with total knowledge of this information I'm describing, they're going to set new horizons for humanity.
I mean, how many of these children do you believe are on the planet now?
Do I believe?
Yeah.
I have really no way of...
No way to know whether there are 10, hundreds, thousands, who knows. Huh? Let's let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is James calling from KNLV, Las Vegas.
Welcome, James.
Hello, George, and hi, William.
Yes, sir.
Hey, I'm really glad I got a hold of you because I, too, and I don't know if you had said that you're clairvoyant or psychic.
No.
I mean, to know the things that you know, I thought, but I am, and I wanted to, it's so cool because you've touched on a couple things lately, and a few of them, and I just want to mention, and I'd like to know how you feel about this, that I was told by him, the master, that next month, without naming specific dates, because I was told do not mention dates, something, you know, very, very big is going to happen. And then following that, something even greater in a positive sense. And I was one evening fighting with what I felt was evil. And I said, God, you know, what do I say to this? And he said, tell him I am the gate. And once you said that, I said to myself, we're right on now.
Mm-hmm.
We're right on. And I have seen his face, the Lord's, three times. So I just wanted everyone to know, and you, that I appreciate you, George. You're doing a great job.
Thank
you. I love
your
art, wherever you are. And William, what do you have to say about these things? And I thought for sure you were psychic.
Well,
okay, and I'll let you listen on the radio. Thanks, James.
I guess I have. Did you ever see the movie Red Dragon?
Oh yeah, we've all seen that one.
Right, the latest Hannibal Lecter movie.
Yes.
And Ed Norton plays a character who's an investigator, and
mm-hmm,
his special
mm-hmm.
talent is he can put himself into a crime scene. That I feel in a sense, without sounding like I'm vain or a braggart or anything, I can do that. And that's one of the things that I think helped me connect the dots. When I read something, I'm there. And I feel it emotionally, and I feel it at a deep intuitive level that's not necessarily a head thing, but more just a gut thing. And so I follow my gut as much as I possibly can. And sometimes there's just great payoffs, and it usually sends me out of my chair, pacing around the room, going, "Holy, you know!" And that's kind of how I view the difference that I have in some of these texts. But then, of course, my other goal is to profusely document the source material for where I'm getting this. So what I would say is that I use the gut, but then I am also asking readers and listeners, just follow the trail of my research, and I think you'll come to the similar conclusion that I've come to.
Very good. Next up, you are on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the program. See if this thing works. Nope, take it away, Stephen. Let's go to our wild card line.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yes, George.
Yes, sir.
And William, this is Merrill in Ainsworth, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to you on 1110 KFAB out of Omaha.
Well, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
A little jittery, and I'm going to try to get this short, but I've tried many times to get in and it always failed. Of course, you're so busy. Talking about UFOs and all this stuff that William Henry has to talk about and everybody else has to talk about, it all plays in. I was encountered a couple of times, one 30 years ago and one just last year. But for 30 years, I've been studying crop circles. That's been the message. That is the main message out there. And I've been building them. They are free energy devices. Nobody knows. I've just written a book and a video. They're working models here. Anytime you attach a crop circle, if you know what you're doing to your work, you will get at least 50, 60, 75% more work out of your motor, your energy. Like I say, I'm a little jittery here.
Why? You're doing all right.
Well,
take a deep breath and just let us have it.
Well, it's the first time I ever got in, and for 30 years I've been actually in my shop. I make a living as a contractor, but I've been so inspired, and of course last fall even the UFO actually drew pictures in the sky for me out here, and I've never heard anybody say that they'd seen anything like that.
Do you have any pictures for us?
I've got my website.
I can't give out your website, but
no, it'll be up in a few days, but.
All right.
No pictures. I do have a video with pictures of working models of crop circles.
Why don't you do me a favor and get us a copy of that? I'd like to take a look at that. You might end up being one of our guests, and of course you can just email me by going to coasttocoastam.com, and on the left just click contact us and then email me away. He sounded just like Harry Truman, didn't he?
Yeah.
He did. He did. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, Mr. Norrie. And
yes,
Mr.
sir.
Mr. Henry, how are you doing this evening?
Good.
My name is Larry. I'm calling from Madera, California. It's the exact center of California on KMJ 580.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about the, Mr. Henry, the cluster of grapes and the Brook of Escal. And I read all that, and I was wondering where he got the blue stones from, because it seems to simply be talking about fruit only, and it says the vineyards are still there in Hebron today.
All right, tell us about the blue stones again, if you would, William. And
right, yeah, the episode that he's referring to is in the book of Numbers, Numbers 13, and Joshua and his companion go to this place called Eshcol, which again means Valley of the Cluster, as in grapes, and they steal this large cluster of grapes. Now, these grapes are so enormous it takes two men to carry them. And this episode is connected with an observation by Joshua and his companion that the land there eateth the people up. And we don't have time to go into all the explanations or all the reasons to dismiss this story is nothing more than a cave or some other episode, but given that the Anunnaki are involved, we know that Joshua and his companion are stealing something incredibly important from the gods. And when you trace the cluster of grapes, for example, to southern France, you find that they're called the blue apples, and in other instances in the mythology of Ea, who was the Anunnaki scientist that came into Earth in search of these blue stones, we find that they're called blue stones. So that's the connection that I'm making. And again, sure, read it as fruit. Be my guest. But what you're going to miss is a tremendous amount of inspired knowledge. And also, you're going to pass right straight by the path to the ultimate secrets of the mystery school.
Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast. You are on with William Henry. Go ahead. Help us out there, Stephen. We're having computer problems today. Hi there, Wildcard Caller.
George?
Go ahead.
Hey, this is Don in Houston, Texas.
Hi, Don. Welcome.
40 KTRH. tongue tied now. Y'all keep saying gate and everything, and you made some references to the movies and all that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I like watching the Stargate series, and I've watched the original movie over and over again. I just wondering if he's seen that, and on the gate, the emblems on the gate, does that ring a bell with anything that he's seen or y'all be discussing tonight? Or
Oh, yeah, right? Absolutely. You'll find in those movies, Stargate Contact, the Stargate series and others, they're definitely grabbing legit science, and they're using legit mythology, sometimes unknowingly. And they're very accurate portrayals, especially the movie Contact, as I've discussed in several of my books, and George and I talked about it the last time I was on the air.
Yes.
That movie Contact in particular is straight out of Stargate manuals provided to Carl Sagan, the author of that book, by Stargate physicists at Caltech. It's real. Carl Sagan insisted on that. But in my view, when Sagan is portraying this tall device that opens up this gateway into the other realm, what is not being told to us is that this technology existed in the ancient world. In fact, it's kind of humorous to me, in the movie Contact, they show this sort of geodesic dome on top of this pillar. Well, the geodesic dome that they are showing there is almost exactly the logo for the Anunnaki.
Jeez. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast with William Henry. Hi.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
I ride from Cleveland, Ohio, AM 1100. William, what kind of artifacts do you think that Saddam Hussein has? And I wanted to tell you something also before you answer that question. There's a lady that I heard on a radio station the other night. She said that the majority of the stuff, a lot of the stuff in the Bible and a lot of stuff the government's telling us is kind of not really true in a way.
Well, I mean, that's a pretty vast generalization. I mean, I would have to say I agree in spirit, but I don't know exactly what the letter that she's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things that they've done aren't true. Some of the things they've done are.
Yeah, and I get criticized all the time that I'll quote the Bible, but I don't believe the whole thing. Therefore, how dare I even presume to quote any of it?
Mm.
And that's erroneous thinking, in my opinion. And to answer your question, what does Saddam have there? Books, libraries, cylinder seals, portrayals of the ancient gods, maps, and I believe ultimately Stargate technology.
Something that would startle humanity, I believe.
Something that would profoundly alter the existing world's religions, and also the balance of power in our world.
William Henry's been my guest. Again, you can go to his website. It's all linked up with coasttocoastam.com. You just click it on, and there it is. Very briefly, William, tell us again about your little conference you're going to have in February.
Yes, the Blue Apples Conference in Los Angeles. We'll be laying out James Arthur and I will be laying out the mystery of the Blue Apples, and then this is preparatory to our trip to France in May, where we'll be going on site and to various places throughout France, exploring this mystery and bringing home some valuable information, we hope.
Well, you're going to be on Coast to Coast as soon as you get back, aren't you?
Great, yes,
absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks, William.
Thank you, George.
Have a good day.
You too.
For Steve Carr, who's done yeoman's work tonight, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, who's always in the trenches, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehart, the